This week's episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by Mixtape Massacre, Escape from Tall Oaks. It's the upcoming sequel to the cult favorite board game Mixtape Massacre, and it is now live on Kickstarter. But this time, the tables have turned. In this meta-cooperative game, players are placed in the shoes of Tall Oak survivors, fighting off slashers, rescuing helpless residents, and safeguarding the town, all in an attempt to escape the maddening streets of Tall Oaks, or die trying. Though working together at times, in the end, only one will be able to make their escape. Along with new mechanics, the fan-favorite killer scenes and bonus tracks are back, keeping the game retro, fun, and full of jokes and horror tropes. Own the original game? This is pretty cool. Extend the town by combining both games and turn your next game night into a slashers versus survivors party. Welcome back to Tall Oaks, now run like hell. Mixtape Massacre, Escape from Tall Oaks is currently live on Kickstarter until April 5th. Head on over to visittalloaks.com or mixtapemassacre.com to learn more and back the Kickstarter.
Tonight's episode is also brought to you by Fright Rags. Fright Rags is the number one source for horror t-shirts. With specially curated collections created by renowned horror artists, they offer the best art and the best quality anywhere. Brand new this week, Fright Rags has expanded their Joe Bob Briggs collection with three new designs, an enamel pin, plus reprints of all three classic designs. And coming next Wednesday, March 27th, all new officially licensed X-Files gear. Visit fright-rags.com to place an order and use coupon code WINTERSHOCK10 for 10% off your order. Again, that is 10% off by using WINTERSHOCK10 at fright-rags.com.
The Shockwaves team is headed to the 14th annual Texas Frightmare Weekend. Presented by Arrow Video, Texas Frightmare is the Southwest's premier horror convention. The show runs from May 3rd to the 5th at the Hyatt Regency DFW Airport Hotel. Shockwaves will be there, but special guests also include Bruce Campbell, Sam Raimi, Tim Curry, Robert Englund, Lee Majors, Meatloaf, and many, many more. For more details, visit TexasFrightmareWeekend.com. Okay, welcome to episode 137 of Shockwave.
We made it to 137, y'all.
We're almost past the killer POV.
I don't know,
POV.
Man. Becca looks pretty angry at me.
There's We're not going to make it through the episode,
there's some
guys.
There's venom being flung across the table over here.
All right, guys, Alex got some issues.
Last three more episodes, and then we'll beat our killer POV record.
Oh, really? Are we that close?
Tell Elric that.
Damn. We did 140 of those, and there's 137.
Everybody take a drink every time someone brings up Killer POV, but not the Bloodcast.
I bet Killer POV
You mean
better.
The True Bloodshed?
But it is the best show with both of us. This show is the ultimate show.
But so. I think we need to plan something big.
I didn't sell that very well. No one believed me.
We blew past that. I think we need to plan something big for 150, guys. That seems like a big number.
Should we get the producer of Birdemic 2 again? That was one of your faves?
Yeah.
Hey, he gave my daughter a producer credit on that movie, and she was not even born
Enough
yet.
Said about Birdemic 2.
Yeah.
Marnie is a producer on that movie.
So we took a break last week.
Amazing.
Holy shit, you got married.
Oh, yeah. I was going to say, we took a nice restful break. Yes, I did.
Anything horror-filled happen on your honeymoon?
No, but we'd look for bats.
Okay.
Look for bats out there.
Oh, my God. I love bats so much. Were they fruit tree bats? Were they like the giant like flying foxes?
They were called hoary bats.
Oh.
Were they little and cute?
Yeah, they were fluffy. They looked like they had like little fur coats.
Oh, my God. I want one.
I know. They were very hoary.
But we are skipping the wedding, and at the wedding, there was some really cool horror.
So I want to thank you all for coming, by the way. And Rob was one of my groomsmen.
Time?
Yeah. The one thing that I missed at my own wedding was the quartet playing musical.
I hate to tell you this, but that was actually one of my favorite things of the whole wedding.
Explain.
It was great. So,
for a second, you don't know what they're playing, and then because it's classical, it's a quartet or three people?
It was quartet.
Yeah. Quartet, and it's quartet. So classy, and you're listening to music, and you're forgetting, you know, you're just like at any wedding, you're listening to the beautiful music, and then you start tuning into it, going, wait a minute.
This is a Laurie's theme.
The first one was something really strange, though. It wasn't like as obvious.
We argued about some of them. There was, eventually it was like Psycho and Jaws, but there was one where I remember somebody was like, it's burnt off. offerings, and somebody else was like, no, it's the Sentinel. And we were like, what
yeah.
the fuck?
Yeah,
you think he's
Tool.
Playing the Sentinel
There was
at
something
his
that did seem more abstract at the start, but it was really cool, and it was beautifully played. It makes you realize how awesome scores are when they're being played by real instruments, you know, especially horror stuff. It set a really good mood.
I met that quartet at my friend Bill Stevens' birthday party, and when we were planning the wedding, Ciara had a good idea of going, let's bring that quartet in.
Yeah.
So I reached out to Bill. Thank you, Bill. And he gave me his playlist. And I was like, okay, I think we're going to add to that a little bit. And so we had Psycho. We had Halloween. Mm.
The
Twin
Sentinel
Peaks.
Was not on there. We did, because you guys walked down to Falling,
which
was just beautiful.
Yeah. And then we walked away with Kiss from a Rose by Seal.
Yeah.
Because that was a big debate of what was our first dance. And I said, Kiss from a Rose. I mean, like, Batman, come on, let's do this. And she was like, no. But I wound up winning by adding that to our quartet lineup. So
nice. Smooth.
Yeah.
Nicely done. But it was good all around. And the cake was very horror-centric too, which was cool.
Yeah.
So yeah, you did the touches.
Now I got this big black ring on my finger.
Oh, damn.
It's heavy.
Oh.
Heavy burden. I mean, not to scare Rob off here.
Well, congratulations to Rob because Rob got engaged.
Yes.
The very
right
week.
Before.
Right before.
Ryan's wedding. Yeah.
Wow.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah.
All right. I'm joining the club, but no kids for me. So,
we'll see.
Nope. Nope.
Well, speaking of...
can you top it?
No
topic.
Becca's having another kid.
Oh, fuck no. But while you were off in Hawaii, we decided to take a Shockwaves trip to Disneyland.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Which was awesome. Yeah. At least I had a blast.
Well, it was awesome because we had, you know, the excuses obviously was, I think, Rob's celebrations and a perfect guest.
And his fiance hadn't been to Disneyland yet.
In LA. But we didn't, you know, doing Disneyland either with kids, you're limited by that, or you have Rob's didn't have his favorite experience previously at Disneyland, as he's saying. So to have somebody who goes there, literally, I think you're there more than you are at your house.
Quite possibly.
You know, might as well work there. So it was good to have a tour guide. And there's things there we didn't know existed, like tiki room that was super cool.
Becca made us take advantage of like every minute counted.
Yeah.
Which is like, because we didn't know what the hell was going on.
No, I would have just gone to classic four things.
I was just so happy he didn't have kids to worry about. And I'm just like, I don't know where we are. And she just brought us like, all right, in 5 minutes we could do this. And then, you know, 10 minutes from there we can go to this. And then I just signed us up for Fast Pass for this. And we're like, oh my God.
Yeah.
And then it was like, and then there's pineapple, what was that stuff that we had?
The
pineapple ice cream.
That was Dole Whip.
Dole Whip right before the Tiki Show. And it's like, whoa.
Yeah, that's what you have to do.
So it's all like her evil powers, but for good.
I AD'd the entire
She
day.
Did. Yes. And it was kind of remarkable.
Yeah. It was wonderful.
Time we go, load me up on turkey legs and we'll go wherever.
We didn't get turkey legs, but I had the biggest corn dog you've ever seen.
But I did give them. I was like, you have to have the churros and
that was good.
You know, very, choice picked the restaurant.
It's like 10:30, 11 churro. You know, 12.
Awesome.
But yeah, it was all very well
curated.
And
the Haunted Mansion, like one time we were in the line for a little while, it was good. But then one time she's like, oh, I've got this Fast Pass thing. We literally, there's all these suckers in line. We just walked right onto that ride.
Oh,
it was the greatest feeling.
It was wonderful.
I've almost
when you have
it.
Someone that lives there.
Exactly.
Because we did the same thing for the Dole Whip. The Dole Whip had like an hour wait. And I was like, hang on, guys. We just walked up. It was already sitting on the counter.
But I will say this. And then horror related news. I've seen a lot of Yeti movies. And none of them are really good. And there's a lot of Bigfoot movies. And none of them are really scary. You go on the fucking bobsled. We got off that thing. My first thing is like, okay, this thing pops out twice. It has glowing red eyes.
So
and
good.
It's scary and has claws. Just make that movie. All you have to do is make that Yeti a scary Yeti and you've got a movie.
And it's so well placed in the movie. We should. It's so well placed in the ride where literally you are rounding the corner and the thing comes out from around the corner at you.
I mean, he's there to scare.
Yeah.
And that's so cool because it's
works.
Disneyland.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, literally everything we went on had an element of scariness to it.
Yes, Snow White.
And that's kind of what I forgot about with
all
the all early
creepy.
Classic Disney stuff.
Like one of my favorite ones that I hadn't remembered till we went on it, because my son hates that ride because it scares him, is the Pinocchio ride when Monstro, the giant whale, comes out from behind the wall. It's like fucking terrifying. And there's a scene in that where you're inside a cage. Yeah, it's dark shit.
Right on.
I love Disney.
No, it was cool. It was actually really, we had fun. So.
Yeah.
So sorry we didn't give you guys a show last week, but we all got to have a little re-energizer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So now that we're re-energized, Let's talk some movies.
Oh,
oh boy.
Yeah.
I don't know we're going to do that. You're catching me off guard.
I know.
Come on, Elric.
Oh, can we also, well, before we do that, can we just talk about John Carl Beekler, who lost
last
week? John was fighting the good fight against cancer. Mm-hmm. And I know many of you had threw a little bit of money at the GoFundMe campaign that we had posted on our Instagram and Twitter. But ultimately, he lost that fight, unfortunately. So we lost a really good dude in horror who contributed a lot to our childhood with Friday the 13th.
And creatures.
So many creature designs.
I mean, he's the reason Kane Hodder is Jason, which is
Absolutely. You know,
He's the one who cast him.
Yep.
And it's probably my favorite Jason design. I mean, I'll never forget seeing Seven on the big screen.
Yeah. I mean, if we ever saw that film without the edits, it would be amazing.
Oh, yeah.
It would be truly amazing.
It would be one of the best ones.
Yeah, totally.
By far.
Yeah. Have you guys ever, Rob, did you ever interview him at all?
I don't know if I've interviewed him, but I've definitely crossed paths with him several times since moving to town.
So, I ran into him at a Kinko's once, and that was my first time, and that's all I could do was just enthuse about his contributions to Friday the 13th. And he'd like, you know, he took it like a champ, like, oh, this kid's nerding out on me.
Yeah.
But he was super nice.
Also, a big component of Hatchet happening, because Adam Green has told the story before, but Sarah Elbert, who produced Hatchet, had produced the special features for the first Friday the 13th box set, and got Beekler was the first person to actually believe in that project and be like, oh, yeah, no, this is cool. I can do some designs. And it's like, you ever think about getting Kane to play the character? Yeah. So, you know, he's so tied into Kane Hodder and a lot of what we know him for. So, yeah, it's a terrible loss. And that thing we shared, the GoFundMe, was it? I think it was GoFundMe.
Yeah, I think so.
It's still up, and it's now being repurposed for the funeral costs. So if you've contributed, it's still going towards helping his family out. And if you haven't, then you could – if you can, you know, you can help his family. Yeah.
Cool.
So
Really quick, because for some strange reason, Scream has blown up on Twitter this week. I don't know if you guys have noticed. So
that
everybody's
crazy poster that you got.
Oh, no, not the poster. So Netflix Canada did a ranking of the Scream films, and it was fucking bananas what they
ranked. Right, because
one wasn't number one. I retweeted and chimed in, but it then launched into this giant conversation about whether 3 and 4, which was better, was it 3 or 4? And a lot of people were positioning 4 over 3, and I disagreed with that.
Do you have to count the whole movie for it, just the opening?
Well, or not even that. See, this is the thing. This is a good conversation. I like the opening, and I like the end.
Yeah,
the
ending's wonderful.
Because the 4, the end of 4 feels like the most Scream-esque vibe, because it's like the killer stating his or her purpose. And you're like,
and it's very modern to today.
Oh, absolutely. So we want to hear it on our social media. So tweet at us or Instagram us and tell us what you feel is the better sequel, 3 or 4.
A lot of people think 2 was over 1. I'll never understand that. 1 is such a great
movie. 2 is very close to 1 for me, because there's a lot of great suspense sequences in it.
I mean, the opening, again, is strong.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah.
Anyway.
Sticking with 1.
Me too. I'm one and done kind of guy.
When I revisited them last, they didn't hold up as well. Although I like 3 better than 2. And I know people think that's crazy, but 3's got Parker Posey and Lance Henriksen. And
3 is the most Scooby-Doo-esque.
Yeah, there's some
fun
stuff in there.
It's like a big whodunit.
Yeah, and that is the problem of the series for me, ultimately. That's why 1's so good. But after that, it's always like, who's the least likely suspect? Make them the killer. And you're like, yeah, but who cares? You know, but the kills are good, and Wes is doing a good job throughout. But yeah, it's the story I care less and less about. Yeah. But Timothy Oliphant is fun to watch chain in number 2. Yeah. Doing his best Jack Nicholson.
Yeah. I guess I could kick this off. So I watched a movie that I know Elric has rated this before. So I got this from Severn Films a couple of months ago, and I was about to watch it, but I didn't think I would enjoy it. And then my girlfriend, now fiance, she saw a picture of the creature and insisted I wait for her. So not only did I wait for her, but we ended up watching this with our good friend David Scow and his wife Carrie, because – David Scow is the number one authority on the creature from the Black Lagoon. But more importantly, when I went to his bathroom, his toilet is actually the horror of Potty Bench. Spoof of the movie I'm holding my hand, which is the horror of Party Beach. I just thought this was going to be really ridiculous and silly, because the creatures just look
cucumber penis mouth.
They look like they're wearing like kind of like a garbage bag sort of thing. But here's the thing. Once the movie kicked off, you know, because it opens up trying to be kind of like one of those like beach movies.
Teen beach movies, yeah.
Oh, this is the hot dog mouth monster.
Yeah. The hot dog mouth monster.
Hot dog. That's very polite of you. You're the only one.
So the first few minutes are just, you know, it is whatever because you think it's going to be a traditional like beach movie with like, you know, music and just whatever. But once they introduce the creatures, plural, because there's a bunch of them, basically there's like this toxic chemical that opens up at the bottom of the beach and it infects a skull and some sea creature that combine and become this thing.
A sea cucumber.
And basically they live on blood. Oh. So they keep coming up to the surface and feeding on people and then disappearing. And it starts this whole and nobody knows how to catch them. So it starts this whole thing. It's like, well, who's killing all these people? What are these creatures? Yada, yada. And so it's actually kind of a cool creature, like a 50s B creature feature. And at one point, they're trying to figure out, like, they're like, you know, we need water samples to figure out where these things are coming from. And I'm like, maybe they're near lakes where the sightings were. Like, I don't know why you're going to go to every, like, lake in the area and do, like, tests when that's not, you know, what you need to do. But anyway, I had a lot of fun with it. It was actually better than I thought it was going to be. And it just fit kind of in that if the creatures didn't look so ridiculous – like, because they kind of in the dark a lot, and so there's certain sequences where they look kind of cool, and then you get a good look at it, and you're like, all right, this is kind of ridiculous. But I still had fun with it, and I think it's actually kind of a cool Saturday, Sunday morning sort of old-school horror movie.
At 78 minutes, you can get away with anything.
Exactly.
Yes. Now, and I think you saw this on the big screen,
this
right?
This was part of one of the new Beverly all-nighters. Part of that lineup tended to be at like 1 a.m. I think they always put a classic monster movie, an older film, in the lineup each year. So one year I saw this, and then one year was the Monster of Piedras Blancas, which I love that monster. That might be one of my favorite design monsters for these kind of movies. But and they're both pretty fun. This one's funny and funny and strange, but I remember, you know, beach movies are totally not my bag. Like if there's a subgenre that just I don't get, it's kind of the American beach movie, even though it's cool and probably a lot of them are musicals.
How do you not get the beach movie?
Because I didn't grow up, I don't know, with these heartthrobs and like, what is Gidget doing? I don't get it.
You're falling in love, Elric.
The thing that really threw, we were talking about in Pure Cinema, every Gidget movie is a different actress playing Gidget. Every year they had to I didn't understand that. I'm like, why?
Because she has to stay 16.
Well, okay. I wanted an older Gidget, older woman Gidget.
That's Emmanuel.
Oh, well. Actually, I do like Emmanuel.
I
got a question.
But again, there's a new Emmanuel in almost every
Emmanuel
film.
Yeah, that's true. No, you're right. Yeah, even Space.
Oh, no. Is there?
Yeah, she's different a lot of the time. Not every
they
single one, a couple
around.
Times they played, but yeah, she's right. They were different.
Pretty much different
countries, everything. Yeah.
So when you lifted up Scow's toilet, did it just have hot dogs bursting out of it?
No. Okay, it's just on the top, actually. It's actually really funny. Maybe I'll tweet a photo of it when this episode airs. But
I was going to say, I really appreciate that there's a lot of companies like Severn and Scream Factory that are releasing these 1950s, 1960s monster classics. Because honestly, like these are all the films that I grew up on VHS. And then during the DVD period, I probably kind of refrained from buying them because, you know, I just didn't like have that urgency to rewatch them. But now as I'm getting older, I'm like, I want to go back. I want to watch The Mole People like I discussed a few episodes back. It, The Terror from Beyond Space. I just got the Deadly Mantis. And they're, you know, Saturday, Sunday morning is a perfect time to watch these
movies. No, this is a perfect morning movie. Yeah. And again, it's like something about black and white in high def. Like, I mean, they did a great job restoring this. There's new features. There's a little retrospective on the making of this and about Del Tenney, the director.
Yeah.
And even about the Del Airs. They're the band that So it's super cool. It's a cool release. And again, it's like, of course, Severin would find this weirdo movie and put it out. I'm going to get back to Severin later in the
episode. Oh, my God. They're putting out my New Zealand film I handed to Elijah Wood like, I don't know, 10 years ago when I was here. I was like, you need to see this one. It's a splatterpunk New Zealand film called Death Warmed Up that I never thought this would get a release. Yeah, I've always liked it. I've only ever seen it in VHS my whole life. And but it's the only one at that time. Like the only horror film like that predates Jackson, like in New Zealand's history. So it's it has worth. It's an interesting movie,
Feels like a low homespun, even for and don't take offense to this, even for like New Zealand cinema.
Oh, you mean the country that produced Lord of the Rings?
What I'm saying is, considering some of the New Zealand cinema that was coming out around that time, it feels like was it part of the lottery or any?
I think that probably did have some money.
Okay.
They were doing a little thing for a while there where if they made one horror film a year along with all the art stuff, it would help buoy, you know, the industry. But that would have been one of the early ones.
Okay.
I don't know how that was received at the time. I know all horror was selling to Japan back then, but it is cool. Look out for it. I'm looking forward to seeing it again myself, actually.
Okay. Well, that was the horror of Party Beach.
Great title. I love that title. Death Warmed Up is great. Up, yeah. Do you have that saying here? Is that a saying in America?
Death Warmed Over.
So that means like if somebody said, oh, you look like Death Warmed Up.
Yeah.
You look terrible.
No, you look like Death Warmed Over is what I've always heard.
If somebody just looked like shit the next day, you'd go, oh, you look like Death Warmed Up.
You look like shit.
Okay. Well, that title was not appropriate.
The phrase is, it is useful.
Mate, you look like shit.
You look like shit.
Anyway.
All right, there you go. Horror of Party Beach.
I thought we always went this way, but me and Becca can
say
both
that
find
every
you
week.
Every fucking week, I'm going to draw a goddamn compass on
Becca,
the table.
Becca, Elric, I'm going to go.
No, this is good because we both saw these movies. We went to the double feature sponsored by Shotwaves and the foundation last night.
Yes, it's called Stephanie Rothman Fellowship.
I was going to add the film that is not a rape revenge director.
So, yeah, she is definitely not. Last night at the New Beverly, there was a benefit for the Stephanie Rothman Fellowship where they played two fantastic fun slashers back-to-back, both with female directors. We started with Slumber Party Massacre.
By Amy Holden Jones, who was there, which was super cool to hear her talk about Corman Days and the big story that like blew me away from her filmography is she, and you might not even know this one, Rob, she was about to edit E.T., and she turned it down because she wanted a chance to direct, and only person who would ever let her direct was Corman to make this movie.
Yeah.
So Slumber Party Massacre exists because somebody turned down E.T. That's
good.
And she even knew that there was a big risk.
Yeah.
So it's so cool.
Slumber Party Massacre over E.T., guys.
I'll do it.
But editing it.
I love Slumber Party, but.
But even still, some of the stuff that she was talking about where she was like, she would never have gotten a directing gig. She would only get jobs that allowed her to stand next to the director and smile.
A lot of writing, a lot of
you know, whatever it was to work directly underneath the director. And she talked about how even still after she did Beethoven and
she wrote Indecent Proposal. She was set to direct that and then they wouldn't let her.
How it was still just such a struggle because women didn't direct. It was just this common belief that women could not direct features, like giant features like that. But Corman would always let her.
There's a quote which was Corman didn't care what you were. As long as you're cheap, he would have let a rhinoceros direct.
That's a direct quote from last night.
And I was like, oh, that's pretty accurate. So much that he's a pro woman. It could just be that he's pro being cheap. And
yep,
I kind of like
about
that.
It.
You got to exploit it if you can.
Yeah, and the way that she actually got the job to do Slumber Party Massacre, she found a script that he already owned. She went out and shot like 10 minutes, brought the footage back, and he said, how much did this cost? And she said, like $1,000. And he said, how much to finish this? And she said, like $200,000. And he said, you're now in pre-production. That was it. So
it helps that her husband was the DP on that, and he also shot Taxi Driver. So,
hey,
Michael Chapman. So yeah, but it was a lot of fun. The crowd just absolutely loved it.
And look, New Beverly will be playing a key role in this episode. But the fact that the New Bev was donating all proceeds of a screening like this—that's a big deal. I mean, that's zero proceeds to the house, all going to this foundation. That's amazing. And then the second film was one I was on I knew I'd seen the cover a million times. Sorority House Massacre. I wasn't sure if I'd seen it.
And then
as soon as it opened, I was like, "Yep, I've seen this."
It's a Halloween ripoff.
It starts out super trippy.
Yeah. Well, it's exactly a ripoff of Halloween 1 if Halloween 1 had the story information of Part 2. So if she knew that there's a brother locked in an institution coming for her, but she doesn't remember the brother, and it's all these psychic flashes she's having in dreams, it's pretty bonkers. It's kind of fun. The fashion is incredible. I think the fashion is the highlight of the movie.
By far.
It's really amazing.
Everyone had these amazing dresses and giant shoulders, and it was very fashion-centric where they kept talking about boots and shoes. And that
one's directed by Carol Frank, who was a production assistant on Slumber Party Massacre. And it was great because one of the best gags to a crowd on Slumber Party was the cat, open a cupboard and a cat jumped out, and it just totally worked. That's the exact scene they're watching in Sorority House Massacre. So I was like, all right, that was fun. Double reference within two 2 hours.
And
nice.
In Slumber Party Massacre, they are watching Hollywood Boulevard, which she had edited.
For Joe Dante.
It was
actually a perfect double feature because they're both like 80 minutes. So it flew by. It was super fun. But big shout out to, you know, people who support this kind of stuff and throw down. That's huge to raise this kind of money. People are still accepting donations for this charity, right?
We are, actually. We have a PayPal set up, RothmanDonations@yahoo.com. You can just send it straight to us if you'd like to donate. Nice. We'll put that up on the Shockwaves page as well.
I saw a lot of people asking Facebook for tickets because
it's sold out.
It sold out really quickly.
Oh, congrats. That's awesome.
Yeah, it was a good time.
While I was away, I revisited Ghost Ship. I don't know if you guys remember Ghost Ship.
Greatest
not Death
opening
Ship.
The Canadian ever.
One? No, the... not the Death, not Death
oh,
Ship.
The haunted
Ghost
Ship.
This is the Dark Castle.
Somebody recently was on our show within the
well,
last
we were
few talk, months.
Well, we were talking about Steve Beck, the director.
Oh, right. We all love the opening of Ghost Ship. So.
Yeah, the opening of Ghost Ship holds up incredibly well. Because it's just basically about a cruise liner coursing through the ocean and a bunch of people on the dance floor, and this wire cuts through everybody everybody dies, which is amazing. This is the film with also Gabriel Byrne. You got Desmond Harrington from Dexter and what was that
Love
movie?
Object.
Love Object. Yeah,
Robert Parigi, good guy.
You know, this movie came out at a time where, you know, Dark Castle was on a pretty successful streak. You know, they had done 13 Ghosts before that, and then they did the House on Haunted Hill remake. And I actually enjoy both of those films.
Mm-hmm. House on Haunted Hill remake's awesome.
Oh, so good.
It holds up.
Yeah, holds up really well. Ghost Ship kind of does, kind of doesn't.
It's interesting that everyone I know remembers the opening, but I couldn't even tell you what happens after that.
Well, that's where it kind of veers off course.
That's a long way to go.
You like that?
The opening's like 5 minutes.
There you go. Basically, you got Gabriel Byrne, Julian Margulies, and their crew, and they're basically like they're salvagers. Mm. And Desmond Harrington brings them information about a cruise liner that's been missing for ages. And Gabriel Byrne's like, I've been looking for this ship for a long time. Oh my God, there was a rich history behind it and a kind of a sordid history behind it. And they go out and they go find it. And then a little ghost girl shows up and starts to haunt them. And then their tugboat blows up and they're stuck on this ship. And then they're stuck with the ghosts and goblins that are there. And what you discover is that there is a not so much the ghosts to fear, but a malevolent force that has guided them to the ship and the gold that is on it. Mm-hmm. The twist, interestingly enough, is refreshing and it's kind of cool, but it comes in way too late into the film because I feel like it should have come in about halfway through and then you'd have to like obviously kind of course correct the story. But knowing that information, I feel like it would have yielded a much richer character piece to explore. But for now, what you have is this great movie with a cool opening and a cool ending, and then just like a lot of just walking around the boat. And, you know, they put a couple of people on a mission to seal up the hole because the ship is taking on water. And then you've got the kind of jokesters played by Carl Urban and Ron Eldard, I think. And they're just kind of hanging out being jokesters. And then you've got
Carl Urban,
like,
that's not a jokester in my mind.
Yeah. Well, he's kind of like – this is like pre
– Judge.
You know, all that kind of stuff. Yeah. And it looks good. There's some cool effects, but the motor to the movie isn't as strong as I remember it. And I used to be kind of a strong defender of this film, but just kind of revisiting it, having put a little distance, it's okay. It's okay. I can imagine for a generation of horror fans who obviously grew up on it and much younger when they saw it, it's a pretty effective ghost story. Yeah. But I don't know. I was just kind of like,
how about a quick Turek flashback? Because one thing they did played last night, they did all these trailers for either movies written by Amy Holden Jones or directed by a woman. Mm. And one of the trailers that is so freaking good as a trailer, and it's just Jaws, was The Relic, which mm-hmm. you were just talking about recently. And
that showed the trailer for The Relic?
Dude, that trailer was so good that I wanted to leave the theater and go home and watch The Relic. Like, I'm not kidding. If Relic had come up next, I would have stayed for a third movie.
Did The Relic use the Dracula score? It was like, dun 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 dun.
Yeah, I think it was something. I didn't know it.
I screamed out, Cahoga for life.
No, it was so good. It builds it up in a way where you're so in, and then it even has you know, the show must go on, just like the Amityville Island. It's it's so ripping off Jaws in all the right ways, and it is a great trailer. Right. So
yeah. Were you able to see scenes? I mean, like, could you actually see what was happening?
Yeah, no, it's yeah. beautifully lit, dark movie. Just like the movie.
They just brightened it up. I think they brightened it in post.
I think you watched it on the wrong TV.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
But it was a good trailer.
Yeah, it is a tight trailer.
Anyways, I watched Ghost Ship on Netflix. It's now available if you want to give it a revisit. One thing I realized that I never talked about on the show after I watched it is Death Ship. I bought the Blu-ray of Death Ship.
Oh, yeah.
The
Canadian one.
I don't remember talking about it, but holy crap,
it's
that movie is insane.
At some point, yeah.
It's just like a fucking ship just racing around the ocean.
Nazi ghosts. And yep.
That's all I remember is Nazi ghosts and the loudspeaker.
Richard Crenna, I believe.
Yeah, the loud. Yeah. Richard Crenna, but it's just the ship is just racing into cruise liners.
Yeah.
That's all it's doing. It's just racing around the ocean, blasting into
being Nazis over the PA system.
He's possessed by Nazi. Yeah, no,
and there's film. I remember a film strip. Like, there's a film strip playing at some point.
Yeah, I think of Nazi propaganda. That would actually double feature with the Crawl Space World, the one with Kinski going crazy with the Nazi stuff. I think those two are both kind of grimy.
Anyways.
So I watched the new fancy Scream Factory release of Screamers.
Oh, which, how does that hold up?
2.5 stars from Becca.
Thank you. Thank you.
I'm on a roll.
So not as well as I remember it. I really liked this movie when it came out in the 90s, and I was a big fan of the Philip K. Dick story, and I watched it last week, and there is so much plot in that movie. I definitely reached a point where I was like...
That's not what my memory would have
been. Okay, so just to give you the setup that happens before the movie even starts... There is a planet and there are some miners on it. And then the government comes in and says, you're going to mine here. But then when they're mining, it releases all the toxic gases and the miners get pissed off and they break off into one group. And then the government is also a group. But then another group of miners come in to break the strike line.
What?
And this is all before the movie starts. This is in the crawl. And I'm like,
let's get to Peter Weller.
Okay, yeah. So then we are now with the Alliance, who was the group of scientists that came in to research the toxic gases that were released when the initial miners came in. And the Alliance is now in a battle with the NEBs, the NEB, the New Economic Bloc, who was made up of the existing miner. Exactly. Exactly. The whole cool
Keep
point.
Keep going. I'm so in. I love this.
So the whole cool point. At some point, the Alliance decided, hey, to fight the NEBs, let's make these things called Screamers. And they're these little machine things that detect human heartbeat, and then they jump out of the ground and they throw like saw blades at you. And then that's awesome. But the problem is they say that they built this whole plant to make the Screamers underground. It's self-automated, and then somebody pushed like the go button and then left, and they've been doing their own thing since then. So these Screamers now attack the people on the Alliance side.
Wait, they just built this huge mythology. They basically turned on a switch and can't turn it off.
They just turned Cyberdyne systems on.
They
were like, here you go.
At one point, somebody comes in and asks Peter Weller, like, have you ever tried to turn off the machine? And he's like, we don't go down there. And you're like, but that seems like the simplest solution. So anyway, both sides, NEB and Alliance, are now plagued with these Screamer things that if you get too far outside, they'll jump up and attack you. So everybody has to wear these bracelets to cover themselves up. As far as they know, there is only one type of Screamers, which are also called like autonomous mobile swords, AMSs. Again, really confusing shit.
That's a lot of bingo.
So this guy shows up and says, I'm a soldier. The war's over. We're trying to create a truce. And we're just all going to sit tight here. There's going to be a truce. And I don't even know all the politics that went in. But then some government guy contacted him and was like, there's not a truce. And then the guy's like, no, there is. So Peter Weller says, fuck all you guys. We're going to walk over to the NEB enemies who are, you know, a few hundred miles away. And we're going to ask them and we're going to make a truce on our own. And so then they start this crazy trek across the desert, and for some reason it's snowing in parts to try to get to the NEB, which is the enemy base.
Hey, Becca.
Yeah.
Is Jennifer Rubin in this movie?
Yeah.
Is she dreamy?
She's in it. Okay, so I'm getting to that. Okay, so here's the thing. So they finally get so they fight Screamers the whole way, and on the way they find out that one of the Screamers is not just this underground creature now. It's a little boy who's asking to come along with them. And when they break open his brain, they find that it says Screamer Type 3.
Whoa.
But if the things underground are type 1.
Type 2?
What is type 2? We don't know.
It's diabetes.
And so you think that that's going to be the whole thing of the movie. So then they finally make it to the enemy base, but they've discovered that those little boy type 3 Screamers have killed everybody at the base, and the only three people who are left are two dudes and the girl. And what it gets weird is Peter Weller and her are alone for about 30 seconds before Peter Weller, and literally he has just met her. He knows her only as this enemy mercenary, and he immediately stops and he goes, "My God, you're beautiful." 30 seconds. 30 seconds there.
We talked about this on the way to Disneyland. Yeah. Me and Rob were like, yeah, that's all it takes in the after apocalypse.
And like, she's changing, too. She's like got her shirt off, and she's like trying to change discreetly in the corner, and Peter Weller's interrogating her. And then all of a sudden, he's just like – and she's got her shirt off, changing discreetly in the corner, and he's like peering over like, "My God, you're beautiful." 20 minutes later, he's making out with her.
Whoa.
Like you do. And so you think that the entire build of the movie is going to be, what are the type 2 screamers? My God, what are the type 2 screamers? So literally within about 5 minutes of him saying, "What are type 2? Somebody goes, "Oh, they look like soldiers who are asking for help." And then suddenly, like, the whole what you think is going to be the mission of the movie is just dead. So then you know that if you see a soldier asking for help, it's a screamer.
Hmm.
But honestly, it's the screamer part is awesome. Like, things jumping out of the ground with crazy saw blades flying at you, impaling all of your limbs. Awesome. Mm-hmm. The politics that went behind it gave me a headache. And I really like the Philip K. Dick story. It's the name of it is, I think it's called Type 2 or Version 2 or something like that. And I really like the story that it's based off of. Why is everyone taking pictures of me right now? Y'all weirded me out.
We're actually been live streaming because you're so passionate about the
Screamers. I know.
And actually, the best part is I only did it halfway through and people were already tweeting, "I know that crappy movie."
You described it pretty well. The Screamers rock. I have no idea what was going on with all the politics and the mercenaries and the miners and the Nebs and the Alliance.
At the time it came out, Becca, I relate to you. I mean, like, when it came out, I was like, wow, this is kind of cool.
Yeah.
And I like Jennifer Rubin, and I like Peter Weller, and
exactly.
I like the monsters in it.
Yeah.
And you know what? It just doesn't sound like it holds up.
They shoved a shit ton of plot into that movie.
Our late teen selves just gravitated to it because it was...
Things jumping out of the ground with saw blades. Yeah. But now I'm like meticulously trying to figure out the politics of this planet going, I don't even know whose side this guy's on.
I bought that on Laserdisc.
Wow.
That's how much I loved it.
Wow.
So
They made two, didn't they?
They did. I have not seen the second one.
Like 2009?
Yeah.
Just watch like Tremors and Splinter.
But I will say, the screenplay... So I was right. The Philip K. Dick story is called Second Variety.
Hmm.
But Dan O'Bannon wrote the screenplay for this. And apparently it went through a bunch of different versions. Like, he wrote it in supposedly like the 80s. It was like a decade prior. And then they came along, they dusted it off and said, "Hey, let's get this done." And then somebody, Miguel Tejada Flores, rewrote it.
Are you going to make a documentary on it?
Yeah, streamers? I'm totally.
It feels like we're going down that level of detail or minutia right now.
I also started researching the whole politics of the planet after watching it. So, yeah. But that's Screamers.
Coming soon to Scream Factory.
It is still fun. I do have to say.
Out now or did you get a screener?
I think it was a screener. I think it may have just come out.
Well, yeah, it's out officially. Yeah.
Okay. It's still fun to revisit. Don't get hung up in the politics.
Okay.
Somebody's going to now. Write a nasty
politics of flow chart next week. And
Rob, what do you got?
So our good friend Josh Miller came over to keep me company earlier this week. Anytime I mention him on the show, you should expect the questionable. No, he had whiskey. I was trying to fight this cold off. But he insisted. He's like, "I saw a little bit of this movie in a bar with no audio and knew immediately that I had to watch it with you." And that is Zombies the Beginning, which is actually the final film by Bruno Mattei, the director of Hell of the Living Dead and Rats, under the name Vincent Dawn, because he went under that name quite a bit. So this is in 2007. It is his follow-up to Island of the Living Dead, which was the prior year. And it's also, unfortunately, this is the year that he passed away as well. But here's why Zombies the Beginning is amazing. First of all, this is on DVD from Intervision, which is Severin Films. Because
they're crazy straight-to-video kind of.
They love Bruno. So let's go back a little bit. Bruno made a little movie called Shocking Dark in 89 that was released as Terminator 2 overseas and yet is actually a ripoff of Aliens. So what does he do? He waits till 2007 to make a zombie ripoff beat for beat of Aliens again.
Awesome.
And I mean, this like Shocking Dark is not as big an Aliens ripoff as Zombies the Beginning. It literally opens with a girl being found on a floating she's found floating in the ocean, not space, by a crew.
On Earth?
On Earth.
Okay.
From an island. She's like a Filipino actress who is also an Island of the Dead. So I don't know if the one before this is the actual prequel, even though this is called The Beginning. I think it's the sequel to the last one.
I don't know what's more confusing,
one.
Screamers or this?
I think they are meant to merge.
Yeah, Bruno Mattei would have made a version of Screamers.
Anyway, the point is, literally, and I'm not even kidding, dialogue and beat for beat. So in Aliens, they find Sigourney Weaver in space.
Right.
They pull her. She's like, I was on, you know, LB whatever. There's aliens, blah, blah, blah. Same deal with her. She's saying there's zombies on this planet, on this little island. You can't go back. She has a nightmare where the zombie actually comes out of her belly, just like the chest burster. And then, of course, they get an elite team of military to go back to the island with her. One of them is a wisecracking guy who is no Bill Paxton. Mm-hmm. I could tell you
is
that
he Filipino?
Much. No, it's mostly the people on the island are Filipino. All the soldiers are American. And there's even a Burke guy whose name is Paul. And so we're like, did they just call the Paul Reiser character Paul? Because why bother? But here's where it gets fun. Because, okay, aliens you could understand. So we're watching this beat for beat. There's no Newt. That's the only, you know, element. But we're like, okay, I know how this happened in Aliens, but how is it going to work with zombies? Because they all have trackers and all that kind of stuff. There's actually kind of disturbing basically I think the zombies like impregnate people and so they have zombie babies.
Okay.
But they're sort of fully formed, so it's like a little person playing a zombie baby.
Oh God.
Yeah, and you're like, oh. So it's like they kind of almost border on looking like aliens. And some of them even have egg-shaped heads. But literally, I mean, I'm not even kidding, even dialogue, it was just aliens. And all we were hoping for was like, holy shit, I hope a queen shows up. And it's like a giant zombie gorilla or something. Because there is a moment
it's just
where –
a robot monster.
Well, there's a moment where there's something there's a woman who goes out to fix the antenna, which is supposed to be Bishop going out, who gets killed by something that looks like stock footage of a crazy monkey. And we're like, is that footage from Congo? And I don't think it is. But and there is no zombie monkey. He went back and he's like, no, but they did use footage from Crimson Tide.
Inside,
why?
Because I think they're trying to contact help, so there's a submarine kind of close by.
All right.
Anyway, I lost my train of thought.
Good movie, Crimson Tide.
So, I mean, the only thing I can tell you is that by the time you get to the end, where, of course, she has to go back and fight – it's not a queen in this. It's just a zombie horde.
What makes her go back? Because if there's no Newt, what is her
– what was it?
And it's got the zombie babies.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember exactly because that's the thing. It's like some of the details are so close because there's a Hicks guy that gets bit instead of acid. And so I'm like, well, he's done, I guess, right? Yeah. Unless these zombie rules don't play. And she drives him somewhere and says, I have to go back for I don't know what. Huh. I don't remember. I think just to destroy them.
Oh, okay, cool.
We have to destroy them before we leave. She's got the flamethrower and everything. And so she goes back.
Does she have on a white tank top?
Yeah, at the point she has a tank top. Yeah,
just making sure.
For sure. And so when she goes back, all I have to say is instead of a queen, it is like – it is fucking bonkers. It is just like – I don't want to give away too much. But if you can imagine, they're like, well, we don't have the money to recreate any Geiger stuff. But in this ending scene, we are going to have a wall of zombie people embedded in the wall that are kind of giving birth to these zombie baby things.
Oh, I love it.
Sounds
so
like the closest I'm ever going to get to a Splatterhouse movie. I need to see this immediately.
Yes, you do. And in fact, this was the moment because Josh had kind of written it off because it was so close to Aliens. Yeah. But when this ending scene happened, he's like, this is the reason I had to watch this with you. I looked up and saw this happening at a bar and couldn't believe my eyes. I knew that there was something to this movie.
Wow.
Even though. So Zombies the Beginning is out now from Intervision on DVD.
Ooh,
it is freaking bonkers. It is Bruno Mattei's last movie. If you wanted Aliens but not nearly as good and with zombies, this is for you.
Nice.
Elric, top that motherfucker.
I could, but I'm not going to. I've got one first. I saw a new IFC Midnight movie that's coming out soon from the good guys who are a good new company, Yellow Veil Pictures, who have been doing some fun stuff. It's called I Trapped the Devil.
Mm. How is that?
I liked it. Josh Lobo, who I guess is a big listener of Shockwaves because I've been hearing – that's why they sent it to me. AJ Bowen is one of the stars. Scott Poitras, who's also he's really – I would say Scott's probably the lead in a sense, but they're both on screen. It's kind of a two-person – well, there's three major on-screen characters.
And Jocelyn. Jocelyn Donahue.
She's not on screen much. She's in like a kind of like she plays on the TV as a vision of the past. It's the actress Susan Burke who wrote one of the Southbound stories, and she's really good. Anyway, this is a real – like a Twilight Zone episode actually. It's far more psychological horror than it is gore horror. So basically A.J. Bowen and his wife Susan Burke, they pull up on Christmas night. So it's a Christmas horror film. So that's obviously important with A.J. because he's a big fan.
He succeeded. He did one.
Yeah, he's done one. They pull up to this house and they haven't seen his brother for a little while, and his brother's gone through some sort of tragedy, I think losing his wife and kids in a car accident or something, and he's become a shut-in, and they're a little worried, and the guy doesn't want to see them. He wants them to leave, and there's this very ominous tone to the house. And what you quickly find out is that Scott Poitras believes he has captured the devil itself in the basement, and ever since catching him, he's noticing the crimes and patterns in the universe have stopped. So like there's that one girl who had been abducted all those years ago. Suddenly she was found again, and things are turning because he's caught the evil. And of course no one believes him that he's captured the evil. And all you really hear is, you know, this dark voice behind a door. And so some of it, that's why I mean it's a little bit more like a Twilight Zone episode because it's really about the character dynamics. But I really like it. It's a good slow burn dread horror. And I think the characters are all really good. And it's interesting just to see the power dynamics play out between them and what you believe when you feel this ominous tone of dread behind the door. So I liked it and it kind of makes sense as an IFC Midnight title. So yeah, at some point maybe the director will stop by and, you know, closer time. I think it's like 2 weeks away.
I think it's coming out April 26th.
Okay, yep. So it's nice. Like a month.
Okay.
That's cool.
But it's cool. I think you guys will dig it. And it's cool to see Scott and AJ play off each other in kind of an intense role because they've been in a number of films.
And I mean, they've been friends forever.
Different capacities. So they definitely felt it made a lot of sense to them as brothers because you definitely feel the history. So I thought that was cool.
Hmm.
Awesome.
So the Shockwaves Facebook group that we're all on and participate in, someone had recommended a film that is now on Netflix called Deadly Detention. Mm-hmm. And it was one of those horror films that just suddenly popped up. It was produced last year, got its Netflix debut this year, and I have to disagree.
You couldn't just do it on the forum. You had to take the big card and do it on air.
I mean, it's I have to talk about it on air. It definitely spoke to me in many ways because of like just the setup, because it was basically a Breakfast Club scenario that turned into a slasher film. And I was like, oh, cool. Perfect. That definitely sounds like my vibe. Here you got five kids representing all different stereotypes in the high school environment who have to report to weekend detention. Once you can wrap your head around the idea that because of the school's being fumigated or something, they used an abandoned local prison to hold the detention in. Once you can wrap your head around the fact that the school system would allow that to happen, then you're in for a journey in which these five kids and their teacher are picked off one by one by a disgruntled person, beginning with the teacher. Once the teacher is offed, then the kids are just allowed to free roam around the prison while they try to get out. And the person who is orchestrating the whole thing is locking doors, opening doors, basically guiding them around with no real specific purpose, really. Hmm. You would think that this killer would guide them to an ultimate plan, but there isn't really one. So, you know, you kind of have a bunch of vapid teenagers just arguing a lot. One of them's got really shiny lit up shoes. And, you know, you've got like the pretty boy, and you've got the nerdy girl. You got the athletic girl.
You're angry about their youth.
No, I'm not angry about their youth because I love movies with youth. I love youth. Come on.
old Man Turk likes youth. Let's put that on a shirt.
I like teen horror movies. Yeah. But this was just such a drag. You know what? The strange thing about this film is it was directed by Blair Hayes. And when I looked, I was like, who's Blair Hayes? He did Bubble Boy with Jake Gyllenhaal.
Oh, that's a while ago. That was Jake's first role, I think. Big role. Like
since then, Blair has been doing Christmas movies, but he directed Deadly Detention about a year or 2 years ago. But anyways, it's one of those kind of weird Netflix movies that just popped up out of nowhere. I cannot recommend it.
Well, you guys can weigh in on the Shockwaves group.
Yes, please weigh in on the Shockwaves group.
See where you
please lie
on this one.
And since Becca walked out to go grab our guest, I also wanted to say that since I was in Hawaii, I revisited on Hulu the 3-part Brady Bunch special in which they went to Hawaii and were afflicted by a cursed tiki doll. And we had to watch it because Ciara and I were just driving around Hawaii. And I was like talking about, remember when Scooby-Doo gang went to Hawaii and this happened? And I was like, but you remember when the Brady Bunch went? And then I went, wait a minute, Vincent Price is in that episode.
Yeah. Oh, scary.
And Vincent Price comes in at the end of the second episode and then he's throughout the third. So basically what you have is the Brady's going to Hawaii and then Bobby discovers this cursed tiki doll and it passes around from Brady member to Brady member and bad shit happens to every single one of them. And then there's a great part where, you know, Peter gets it and they're all laying in bed and like Peter puts it on. He's like, bad luck, come and get me. Because Peter's such a dick. And then a tarantula like crawls up on his chest and there's this hilarious moment where he's like screaming like a woman going, get it off, get
it's
it
the
off.
Ash scream.
It was so good. But at the end, when they go to try to bring this tiki doll back to a cave where they think it, you know, where it was originally exhumed, they meet Vincent Price, who is this disgruntled professor who lost his fame in the professorial circles and had discovered this cave that has all of these ancient Hawaiian artifacts, and he doesn't want to leave because he doesn't want someone else to discover it. So he lives there, and very much like Castaway, he starts talking not to a volleyball but to like a kind of giant tiki statue, and he starts talking to it like a crazy person. He ties up the Brady Boys.
You know what? That's also relevant because
really
he's
deep.
Last Man on Earth, where he's also talking.
Oh,
about Jake's
that's very true.
Back,
that so is
that's
very
a good
true.
Vincent Price
a good callback.
Yeah.
But in the third episode, basically what you have is the Brady Boys versus Vincent Price, and then the dad comes along and the dad's like, what's going on here? And Vincent Price goes, well, let me tell you my story. And then they dissolve and the dad's like, well, look, you know what? I completely understand you, but you don't need to tie up the kids.
I love that Becca walked out of the room and came back to Brady Bunch.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, well, no, I was excited because you said Scooby-Doo, and I totally remember the Hawaii
vacation. Oh, yeah, the Hawaii, yeah, exactly.
No,
but the funny, the weird thing about it is Hulu has every Brady Bunch episode on there, except for the first part of this 3-part chapter, this 3-part series. So cause I think it kicked off season 4 or something like that.
I watched it, I want to say, on Prime because – and this is an equally weird story. Years ago when I bought the house in North Hollywood, when we were doing electrical work in the backyard, we dug up a stone tiki. Like it was literally buried in the backyard. I still have it. It's in my living room now. And so everybody kept saying – when I posted up a picture, I was like, I fucking dug this up in the backyard. It was buried in the backyard while they were doing electrical work. And everybody started saying, like, have you seen that Brady Bunch episode? So I went back and watched the Brady Bunch episode.
It's a pretty old Brady Bunch episode. It's still pretty funny. The thing that I laughed about is because I was like, I want that tiki doll. I went on Etsy and there it was, but someone made one. But while we were shopping the next day in one of the local towns, there was a Hawaiian shirt shop that was just selling them. And I was so stoked that I now finally own one.
Wow. So you own the Brady Bunch Tiki.
I do.
That's awesome.
Very happy about that.
So I'll mention The Order on Netflix, which I
know. How is that?
I'm enjoying
it.
Okay, so I'm enjoying it, but I don't know if any of you three will. And I mean that politely. Yeah. If I was 16, I would have gone fucking apeshit over this show. Hmm. And it popped up on my queue because it said, if you like magicians and Stranger Things, you will like this. And I will say, it's the same concept of Harry Potter. It is literally about a school with a secret society for magicians. And so this has been done before because Sci-Fi had magicians a couple of years ago, which is still going, which kind of upped the ante a little bit more, made it a little bit more scary. The characters have sex in that. This is pushing it even further because now it's part of a secret society. There
orgies?
Is evil. Not yet. Okay. I'm waiting for the orgies. But there's monsters. There's like a werewolf that is picking people off on campus.
Right.
They kill each other. It's definitely a lot more intense. Like this one definitely is pushing
it,
the horror envelope.
Like, masks.
Is
really
it in our
masks.
Time? I mean, or is it?
It is. It is
oh,
in our
that's
time.
Cool.
Yeah, it's in our time. It is about a college that people apply to get into. And within the college, there is a very elite society called the Blue Roses. And if you are selected to be a Blue Rose, it's kind of like the Skulls or whatever,
right.
where they say like, you know, these presidents. And Beyonce was a member, and it's really, you know, it's Illuminati-ish.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, all these famous people were members. And but what you find out is that if you are selected to be a member, they actually teach you to do magic. And so, but because of this, like, evil is drawn to the university, which is why they currently have a werewolf problem in the first couple of episodes. And there's bad shit going on within the order. So, again, if I was 16, this would be, like, I would be obsessed with this
but
show.
But you're enjoying it now.
I'm enjoying it
all
as,
right.
like, a guilty pleasure,
yeah.
I'll say. But I've seen mixed reviews. I've seen people being like, what the fuck is this teen shit? And it does. It feels kind of Teen Wolf-y. But I really enjoyed Teen Wolf, too.
Yeah.
So there you go.
The boxing one?
The boxing.
Teen Wolf 2?
Gotcha. Ridiculous.
I like older genre fans who are like, what's up with this teen shit?
Yeah.
When they got the same flack back in the day. It's
no,
like,
if this had been on when I was in high school, I would have been like, this is a gift from the gods.
Oh.
So I'm enjoying it. I'm on like episode 5 now. And
yeah.
I'm like, I'm going to go home and watch some more of The Order. So yeah, I'm still enjoying it.
I'll check it out.
So,
it's
yeah.
in my queue. I want to watch
horror,
it.
It's horror adjacent
it's
enough
our,
that I will mention
Rob
it.
Rob just turned it. It looks like it's got one of our leads from this movie I co-produced called Seven in Heaven up in Canada. Is
which
it Canadian?
Is also
it's
on,
Canadian
it is
production?
Canadian. And Seven in Heaven is on Netflix as well.
Yeah.
I was, it's on my queue as well.
Let me know what you think.
Is that a horror film?
It's
it
not.
Is.
It's a teen thriller.
Oh, Seven in Heaven?
Yeah.
It's in the horror section.
Yeah, it should be too, I guess.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Robbie.
How about you,
Rob? You got anything?
No, I mean, those are my two main ones. I mean, I'll just reiterate really quickly that I hosted a double feature of 10 to Midnight and Cobra, which
nice.
I've been pushing a lot. That is the order to watch them in, by the way, because a lot of people have been doing Cobra first and then 10 to Midnight. But no, I think 10 to Midnight is the gnarlier one, and then you just go all loose on Cobra, you know, because –
both great movies.
I mean, it's Sylvester Stallone at the peak of his powers where no one would say no to him. And so decisions like cutting your pizza with a scissor is an artistic thing, or chewing on a match.
And I believe there's still a chance that Panos will reboot that movie because it did sound like it when he was here.
I would love nothing more than Panos to do
movie.
That movie.
So
there's that. And also, you know, we talked about it was one of my favorites of last year, but I rewatched You Might Be the Killer on Shudder. Because my fiance wanted to see it. And even better on repeat viewings.
I really tried.
Oh, really?
I really tried.
Oh, Becca.
And
I
liked
haven't seen
it.
Yet, so.
I liked it on the first pass, but then the more I thought about it, I was kind of like, I don't know. Like, it seems so on the nose to me looking back on it.
And I disagree with you.
Then maybe I need to watch this to see
again.
If it's approved.
I need to watch it again.
You liked it a lot, right?
I think it's great.
Yeah, I loved it. I loved it. Well, it's like, you know, it's like 10 years ago, Behind the Mask was that movie for me. That was taking what I love about the genre and breaking it down in a unique way. But again, it's like the first time you watch this one, you're just wondering how they're going to sustain this premise for 90 minutes. And the second time, I'm just having fun going with it because now I know where all the beats are coming. And it's almost funnier that way when you know what's about to happen. So
okay, I will rewatch because I enjoyed it the first time through but didn't get to finish it, admittedly. I only made it like 75% of the
and
way
the
through.
And the ending is the best part.
Okay, then I definitely have to finish it.
I will watch it.
Okay,
and then
good.
We'll see where
it's on Shudder.
I do have to tell you guys something. This was a major discovery for me. I'm very excited about this. If you listened to the New Pure Cinema where we did paired kids films and midnight films, I discovered a movie called Night Beast. I didn't discover it, but because it plays in Mandy, Nick Cage is watching in Mandy. I was like, what is that movie with this amazing monster?
Yeah.
And when I watched Night Beast, I felt like it was like a religious experience where I was seeing a homemade backyard movie that was just utterly brilliant and epic and, you know, just one shade short of being a porn film, but also somebody's backyard horror movie with an amazing beast. I loved it so much. And so that made me go, I need to know everything about this director because I'm now in love with Don Doler, who I know a lot of people probably already know. So I watched Night Beast a few weeks ago and had to wait till that aired. But so now I went back and watched his first film, Alien Factor, which is basically just Night Beast, but with a different creature. It's nowhere near as good. But I mean, but it's still got some really creative choices. But what's really cool, so if you get into this, there's a couple cool stories. He's a Baltimore filmmaker who in 1978 made Alien Factor and about 81 made Night Beast. And when he was making his Night Beast, he got a letter from another guy who lived in Baltimore. So everyone knows John Waters is a Baltimore filmmaker. He got a letter from a 15-year-old J.J. Abrams who said, I heard you've started you're a local filmmaker. I just want you to know that I am also going to be a filmmaker and I make special effects sounds. And so he ends up going and doing sound design work on Night Beast. And he still talks about Dollar being his big first break, which I love. I just love it because it's literally – Super 8. I mean, Don Dollar is the old man, older man version of the kids in Super 8 making that backyard movie, and JJ is part of that process, which I love. But
JJ seems JJ as a kid was very active, apparently.
I mean, he was literally writing to people getting things.
Yeah.
In the local movie. It's so cool. But this documentary, which is on Amazon Prime, it's called Blood, Boobs, and Beast, because they are the three B's he was told you had to be in a movie for it to sell. Unfortunately, and I take this wrong, don't take this the wrong way, but I don't think this Night Beast suits Troma, and Troma's who they now have landed with. I feel like it has a very different aesthetic than what Troma movies are. And so Troma has put that out, and they've also been part of this documentary. The documentary, I would say the parts on just Dollar are great, and then the parts of fans and stuff talking about it, it's pretty terrible. But this documentary opened with my favorite thing this year, which was it just cuts to a close-up of this guy, Don Dollar. He's probably 65 when he looks like – you know how when you meet Herschel Gordon Lewis, you're like, that guy made films? Mm-hmm. This guy even more so. He looks like an accountant, glasses, and he's telling a story, and it's really intense, and it really inspired me. He's like, you know, so I was like 30 – I think he's like 32 or something, and I have a family, you know, wife and kids, and I wake up in the middle of the night and a guy is standing above me and he puts a shotgun to my temple and at this point he was like in some sort of business, you know, that was his job, and he's like, and I'm on the ground and the guy's gun is at the, and this is the opening shot of this documentary, the gun is at my head and I'm on the ground going, oh, any second now my brains are going to probably be blown up onto this floor, and all I could think about is I never made that movie I always wanted to make. And if I survive this night, I'm going to make films and I'm going to stop everything I've been doing in my life and just focus on what I actually want to do.
Shit.
And that's what he did. As soon as he survives this night, he then just throws away his entire career and life and just goes, I'm going to make my first movie for 30 grand and put it together, and then made another one. Wow. And another one and another one. Ugh. He ends up – he directs like 5 films, and then he got really screwed on one film by distributors, so he stopped directing and they started producing more small things. It's kind of a sad story of how he got kind of the end of his directing part. But it was just super inspiring. I love – I'm sure this is mentioned in Nightmare USA because he's one of those figures. I just can't recall it. But Night Beast, I would – like personally, don't start – I would just start with Night Beast because I love every – I mean it's a giant monster who looks like – it kind of literally looks like the Relic but on two legs with a ray gun.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's called Night Beast, and then 90% of it takes place in the middle of the day.
I do remember –
which is ludicrous.
I do remember the monster.
I loved it. I had so much fun. And they're all super short. I haven't seen Fiend. That's one I want to see next. But
yeah, this one's on its way to me.
But for the documentary, I think it's really – just worth even watching some of the stories of just how he got into it. And this regional filmmaking is so – I mean now it's a little different because it's so much easier now to get a digital camera and shoot. But anyone who is doing this on film is just totally inspiring to me.
Wow.
And always makes you rethink your own life, because I kind of had an experience like that when I got run over by a car, where I switched – afterwards you switch gears with what you do because you reshift your focus. But that can also run out after a few years. You get complacent. So it's good to remind yourself you are on a ticking clock.
How about I scare you every
I think I need that.
Every couple months, near death experience.
I need one of them. But Don Dollar is now one of like seriously one of my favorite things I've seen this year. Is just it's just so much fun, you know.
I had the time to finish True Indie, which is Don Coscarelli's book.
Yeah,
and I had a lot of respect for Don. I have a lot of respect for Don, and that just kind of went through the roof after finishing this book. Like mad respect for Don after like his career and what he's done and what he's accomplished and what he's overcome. It is a remarkable book with a lot of great anecdotes. I mean, like there are stories in there that I was just like jaw on the floor. I was laughing with it. There were things I didn't know about him or his career.
He's still relatively young. And that's
he
what
is.
People forget.
Well,
he's
that
well,
he started.
So
he started young, and he's still young. I mean, like he's still relatively young. And you can listen to our interview with Don many episodes back. But some of the anecdotes, man, there were some great stuff. I mean, like I'd laughed about you know, when he was test screening Phantasm, and Angus Scrimm, you know, snuck himself into the test screening and dressed as like an old sophisticated English gentleman and was playing the part. So like people didn't go, oh, that's the guy from Phantasm. That cracked me up. There was a moment where he was talking about a DP, a very successful DP now, who was driving down to Angeles Crest Highway in a grip truck where the brakes went out. And it flew down the Angeles Crest Highway. And if you, you know, live in out here in LA, you know that's a very scary stretch of road. He was able to navigate through the whole thing. And by the time he got to the bottom of the hill, he could either swerve right and take out two women who were trying to cross the road, or swerve into a Denny's parking lot with a Cadillac. And he swerved right into that Cadillac. Mm. And he survived the crash. Obviously, all the equipment that they had for the film was destroyed. But I was just like, oh, my God. And when they mentioned the name, I'm blanking on it. I'm dying to remember. But the guy was like, oh, he's also a successful fucking DP today. And I was like, Jesus. But there are some amazing stories.
Yeah, it's been sitting on my shelf because I think the only thing that stopped me from reading it was because we did the Miskatonic with him.
Yep.
And so we were there for like 4 hours of him telling stories.
All these stories.
It killed a little bit of that rush, but I love him so much.
The structure of the book itself is very fun. I mean, like every other page feels like it's a new chapter, and he keeps the flow going.
Do you think he's still, having read the book, do you think he's still jonesing to make another movie himself? Or, I mean,
oh,
I know
absolutely.
That never goes well. I want to see another.
But yeah, I feel like, joint, yeah. But I feel like after reading it, it has to be on his terms. And
yeah.
What his terms to me feel like are having the time to make the movie. You know, John Dies in the End wasn't a quick shoot. It felt like it was just piecemeal together over weekends and da da da. And needing the amount of shooting days he wants and the budget.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, I mean, like, I would love to give that to him if we found the right story, you know, but
yeah, he talked
it's
about
all about that,
that
time.
The talk back, that's what he was holding out for was, you know, most horror now people are looking for like $750,000. We'll get you that tomorrow. And that he wasn't going to settle for that.
Well, that's exactly it.
Yeah.
Yeah. He wants a budget and he wants the time to do it, you know, and today, you know, generally, you know, movie shoots are 25 days, at least for us, it is, you know, and like more, you know, you know, he kind of has these like 10 tenets of filmmaking. And I was reading them. And I was like, yeah, that's all great. It's all good in a, you know, an ideal world. But, you know, the industry, what the book charts so well is how the industry has changed from like the head of Universal just giving a kid a shot by buying his movie.
Who just passed away.
Sid Sheinberg also gave
Spielberg a big break.
Yes.
So I remember Don saying that was a huge deal for him.
Huge deal. Yeah. But, you know, would that happen
and
today?
There's fun stories like him having the naivety of not realizing how big a guy he was. And like he's 19 on the set of Universal and just going into his office like, sit in. We want to talk to Sid.
Know,
like, who are these kids that think he just walk in?
Yeah.
And he's like, boys, come in.
Yeah. So
that's
wild.
Pretty cool. You
know, it's a really great book. And I recommend it not just for horror fans, but anybody who just is like into film history or wants to be a filmmaker.
Yeah. Cool.
Cool.
All right. We're going to get to our guest. We have a crossover, I guess, with my other life from the New Beverly and somebody who helped you put on the show.
Yep.
And we'll be excited to introduce her in a second.
Cool. This week's episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by Mixtape Massacre, Escape from Tall Oaks. It's the upcoming sequel to the cult favorite board game Mixtape Massacre, and it is now live on Kickstarter. But this time, the tables have turned. In this meta-cooperative game, players are placed in the shoes of Tall Oak survivors, fighting off slashers, rescuing helpless residents, and safeguarding the town, all in an attempt to escape the maddening streets of Tall Oaks, or die trying. Though working together at times, in the end, only one will be able to make their escape. Along with new mechanics, the fan-favorite killer scenes and bonus tracks are back, keeping the game retro, fun, and full of jokes and horror tropes. Own the original game? This is pretty cool. Extend the town by combining both games and turn your next game night into a slashers versus survivors party. Welcome back to Tall Oaks, now run like hell. Mixtape Massacre, Escape from Tall Oaks is currently live on Kickstarter until April 5th. Head on over to visittalloaks.com or mixtapemassacre.com to learn more and back the Kickstarter.
Tonight's episode is also brought to you by Fright Rags. Fright Rags is the number one source for horror t-shirts. With specially curated collections created by renowned horror artists, they offer the best art and the best quality anywhere. Brand new this week, Fright Rags has expanded their Joe Bob Briggs collection with three new designs, an enamel pin, plus reprints of all three classic designs. And coming next Wednesday, March 27th, all new officially licensed X-Files gear. Visit fright-rags.com to place an order and use coupon code WINTERSHOCK10 for 10% off your order. Again, that is 10% off by using WINTERSHOCK10 at fright-rags.com.
The Shockwaves team is headed to the 14th annual Texas Frightmare Weekend. Presented by Arrow Video, Texas Frightmare is the Southwest's premier horror convention. The show runs from May 3rd to the 5th at the Hyatt Regency DFW Airport Hotel. Shockwaves will be there, but special guests also include Bruce Campbell, Sam Raimi, Tim Curry, Robert Englund, Lee Majors, Meatloaf, and many, many more. For more details, visit TexasFrightmareWeekend.com.
We are joined by Jules McLean, who is the the director of operations of the New Beverly Cinema.
You didn't screw that
yes.
up.
You got it.
I
yes.
had a minor mind blank. But this is really exciting because I actually don't know – I really don't know much of your origin story besides the video store thing that we all have in common. Everyone at this table has done
more
serious time
oh, I didn't
in
know
video
that.
Store culture.
Origin story makes you sound like a superhero.
You kind of are.
I love that.
Well, she saved the pure cinema by bringing us to New Bev. You got us re-energized. So I have you to thank for that part of this equation, and Phil, of course. I saw you last night at Slumber Party and Sorority House Massacre, and I was like, and bring in some horror titles so we can, because I don't know your horror taste. I don't know what your jam is.
I know. Well, it's not very eclectic. I fear it's like, I'm like, oh no, when you told me that, like, what movies are we going to talk about? And I'm like, oh, did you invite the right guest?
Well, there's lots we want to hear. I mean, like I said, video store culture, mm-hmm. We're always fascinated by it. Yours, obviously, you also have a lifetime friendship that spawned from it, and that's super interesting. That's led you to the job at the New Beverly, which is, I don't know if that's something you ever thought you'd be managing a theater, which is obviously very different than a movie.
That
a video
was
store.
Never in the career path.
yeah. That's what
so
I figured.
So let's start back. What was, like, in the career path? Like, what had you always pictured yourself as? As an adolescent,
an attorney.
Oh wow! Okay.
Oh my gosh! Okay, that's left field.
Yeah. Well, I like to argue.
That'd be helpful.
That's part of it. Yeah, I always thought I'd be, you know, in law, and I was a little bit on that trajectory, but took a U-turn. Speaking of U-turns, and I don't know. I kind of fell into the work I did. I met Quentin. When I was a customer at Video Archives, and then later I became an employee. And I honestly, his passion is very catching. Mm-hmm. So it was just great. We'd always go out to the movies. We'd see like three movies a day on Friday. Oh, wow. When they would open up. We'd go from the South Bay up into Westwood. And you don't know it at the time, but sometimes when you're like 22 and don't have a care in the world and you don't have a mortgage or anything like that, it's a great time in life. So you youngsters out there,
totally.
Enjoy it. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying I don't enjoy my life now, but I'm just saying like, wow, you don't know that you can just go to a triple feature in the middle of a day and
not
into
think about
the evening.
Bills ever,
yeah.
right?
Not think
like
about
feeling.
Bills. Yeah. And you don't realize you're living paycheck to paycheck. And
do you remember the first time you were served by Quentin, like what he might have recommended to you? I'm always curious about what movies you're throwing.
Oh, that's a great question. I don't know specifically the one title that he recommended, but there was always like a may we suggest section. And then there was like another little section where the staffers always like made these cool little index cards. Uh-huh. And I remember he made a Meg Tilly index card that highlighted all nice. her movies and stuff. And I nicked that card. I still have it.
She robbed the place you were then going to work for.
Can you say?
Did you have a love of movies prior to working at the video store, or is that when it really?
No, I have my mom to thank for that. When I was 5 years old, she took me to see Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, so.
Which I just saw at the New Bev recently.
Oh, yeah, I know that's what night. We reopened the New Bev with, which I was so excited that.
But
we
that
did
means
that.
It has a super significance to both of you because
it
I remember
does.
His story was one of the first films he saw in Hollywood. Or something.
Yeah, first film that he saw up
that's
in Hollywood.
That you guys had that.
Yeah, and I didn't even actually know that until he said that story at the Hollywood Walk of Fame or the star thing. So I'm like, oh, I didn't know that. So
wow.
Yeah, but I had my mom. She would take me to go see like the disaster films, like Towering Infernal and Earthquake with the Sensaround. And I'd like run into the lobby because I was so scared. My mom stayed in the theater. It was like, you know, when you didn't run after your kids and it was safe. So I just love movies back. The Great Gatsby she took me to see. The Poseidon Adventure. Mm-hmm.
Did she allow you to see any horror at that young age? Or what do you remember like the first time you saw something that like scared you in a way?
No, she didn't. She was, you know, she tailed back on that because I don't think that was her jam. Yeah. But the first thing that really effing scared me, I was in junior high. I know how old I am. But my mom and stepdad always have kind of date night on Friday. So I stayed home. They gave me pizza money. It was brilliant. Yeah. And, you know, I'd have videos to watch. And I watched the Amityville Horror.
Oh.
And afterwards, I like ran to the porch. I got out of the house and I just waited for them to come home. I did not want to go back in the house. I have not watched it since. I have no idea if it holds up, but
it did a similar thing to me when I was pretty young. Like it makes you scared of the place you're actually watching it. And then you go outside and you don't want to look at the windows because you have that shot with the eyes. I hate that scene.
Well, not even that. I mean, I remember being terrified. I grew up in an apartment, but I remember it was on HBO one afternoon and at the scene where the boys are teasing the little sister. And they've got like a fishing line and they've got like a little fake spider and they're teasing her hair. And then one of the boys pulls his hands back and the other brother's got his hands on the windowsill and the window comes down on his fingers.
Yeah, yeah.
And you see, and it's not even that graphic. It's just like some little stippling on the knuckles to make it look like it's bruised. And I was like, no, I closed all the windows in the apartment. And I was just like, I can't deal with that.
Yeah. Yeah.
It has an effect on kids.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
you don't want to grow up in a haunted house.
The flies did it.
That was so disgusting.
Yeah. 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 So that was part of it. Because I always wonder if, like, horror films, like, even if it's not your number one passion, I feel like seeing that first scare sets you down to watch more. Did that make you watch more or not want to watch anything because you got so scared?
Oh, no. I love being scared to this day. Yeah. I have some of my girls and friends would be like, oh, why do you want to watch this? Yeah. It just scares you. I go, that's why I love it.
Yeah.
So
it's a great feeling, yeah.
You know, I love it. And in particular, I really like the haunted house theme, so... Uh-huh. The Haunting's one of my favorites. Mm-hmm. I like The Uninvited. Mm-hmm. Things like, you know. Like,
yeah, those ghosts tend to be my like the scariest thing to me. Because it's an element you have no control over. Like,
completely.
The supernatural, you can't. Like if there's a guy there with a knife, you're probably going to die, but you might be able to fight them off.
You can fight, yeah.
But with ghosts, it's like, you know, all bets are
off. Don't know the rules, yeah. That's one of the reasons why I've always been more drawn to the supernatural movies than the slasher. I'm always kind of like, yeah, you might be able to run away. But the ghosts, there's no fucking way. No fucking way.
I'm really curious, during your video store days, what was the most creative display or setup that you've ever created? Because I think we all have stories. Because I mean, like, I worked at Blockbuster in Manhattan. So when October rolled around, I was in charge of the window. Nice. And I made sure.
Wow.
I mean, like, and we pushed it. I mean, like, you know, obviously we're working for the man, but I was able to push the boundaries so it drew people in. So they were like, where's that horror section, Turek?
Yeah.
Right down there.
Mm-hmm. Well, didn't you tell us that you were the one that ordered every obscure horror title to make sure that you were
Blockbuster? Oh, we had the best selection.
We had the best selection.
In a Blockbuster in Manhattan. But yeah, and then when I left, they sold it all.
No, I was just going to say, when did they go out of business? Did you buy them for a dollar?
I did.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, no, absolutely. Yeah. Because when I left 2 weeks later, they were like, we're going to put it in their preview bin. And all these titles that I bought for like 25 to 70 bucks,
crazy.
They were like $2.
Yeah,
and
brilliant.
I was like, oh, I'm going to buy all
this. Myself a favor.
Yeah.
Didn't even know it.
But were you allowed to – did you guys have creative freedom to play around and do some fun stuff?
We didn't have any display windows and it was really small. It was probably as big as this room.
No way, so, really?
Yeah, and then the problem is we moved two doors down and it was too big. So then we moved again to like the beach area where there was no parking and then no parking killed us.
Oh, wow.
And it went belly up. Yeah.
And that whole collection is Quentin's.
It's all Quentin's now.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's the one that like you can walk through upstairs. Is it set up the same way?
It is so set up the same way with the sections. He's made some different sections, of course, but it's the same shelves.
Wow.
And he's obviously has more VHS tapes now, so we got – our contractor is a good woodworker, so made shelves to match the old video archive shelves.
Right. Oh, my gosh.
What was that? What was the history of that store? Like, who were the owners of it? Was it just a one-off or was it a chain?
No, it was a one-off. It was started by Lance Lawson, who has pretty extensive film knowledge, and Dennis Humbert, I believe his last name was. So they were, he was more the business guy, and it just kind of took off. It was really like Lance's curation of the collection, and he really he did a wonderful job of buying in really some obscure stuff. And,
did you, is there a key moment like where you realized, oh yeah, this guy's going to make a movie. It's not just talk about movies in a video store. Obviously that's a huge part of video store culture, is talking about, I'm going to make movies one day. I think every single person thinks that when they're working one, but obviously you, your coworker has gone on to become one of the biggest directors in the world. So,
so surreal. Even like just to
hear
you say
that. Right,
because
you knew him before. I always think that's an amazing relationship to know someone before something major changes in their life. You know,
it is no surprise. I'm going to be 100% honest. A, because he was always passionate. Like one of the first times we went to go see a movie, he afterwards, he's all, hey man, because we both like Elvis, do you want to go back to video? And I wasn't working at Video Archives at the time. Do you want to go back to Video Archives and see a really cool fight scene with Elvis? I'm like, well, yeah, of course. So yeah, it was really cool back then. You know, he had the keys to the store, and there's a big screen TV, and there was actually a couch there, and he queued up a fight scene and Loving You, and man, that was great. Like we followed up a movie with, you know, and we would drove back, I think, from Westwood or something. So
so you could tell that that was not going to be a surprising trajectory.
It wasn't. I'll tell you, it wasn't, because A, his passion, and he would do things like out of the blue. He would like call editors and say, hey, man, that scene was really cool, and talk to it. Yeah. And he would like start up conversations with, you know, a lot of film people. But I read he gave me Reservoir Dogs to read one night. This is an interesting story too. So I read it and I'm like, holy fuck, this is so good. And so I drove to the video. I was driving to the video store because I wanted to talk to him about it, because I'm like, oh my God, this is like, this is so fucking good. And I got in this crazy car accident right almost in front of, I was turning left and a drunk driver came barreling down the hill and hit me, and it was totaled, and went to the hospital and everything. And later Quentin's all like, yeah, I heard an accident. I'm like, yeah, it was me. I mean, like 3 days later almost too, it was like, yeah, it was bad though.
Oh, wow. And also that conversation's then delayed,
then I didn't
right?
have a conversation of how great it was. And then I had like, I had a head injury, so I couldn't even talk to him that much about it. So I'm like, oh, I was out of it. But I'm like, oh, that's right. I never got to have that conversation of like, wow, I just read this and it is brilliant.
Yeah. Do you remember?
Then I knew.
Because he did a short first, right?
He did My Best Friend's Birthday.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So were you there around for that period? Or was he still working at the store, or did he leave?
Yeah, he was still working at the store,
That's interesting. That's just, I mean, it's always probably doesn't feel like a big deal when you're in it at the moment. But then when things change, it changes in such a big way. It's hard to imagine. Would you recall any of like crazy screenings that were curated? Like, I'm always interested because now obviously Quentin's doing the bulk of the programming, but you also do some of the programming.
I do a wee bit of
it. Yeah, sometimes you guys
Brian
do the Mad Maze or something.
Phil does, exactly.
But like, I mean, talk us through a little bit about how that, because I'm sure back then, I know when we all worked with video stores, we're also curating nights of our own at our houses, right? And it's really exciting
or
to put
even
screenings together.
Before the end of the night, I am going to ask you what was always on your employee selection chart.
Yes, that's important.
Yes, that's very important.
That's a good one.
Yeah, because I think we all here worked in video stores, right? Yeah. Okay.
Wow, what a cool crew.
Yeah.
Rebecca, I didn't know you worked in that.
I did. I worked through college. I bounced back and forth between Mike's Video and Music, and I worked at our art house movie theater, the Lyric Theater in Blacksburg. So I bounced back and forth between the two. So I was either working the projection booth selling popcorn or slinging DVDs, which were a brand new thing at the time, but we were one of the first shops in town to sell porn DVDs, which were a crazy thing.
Wasn't porn crazy? We had porn at Video Archives.
It
kept us
you
in
got
business.
The strangest customers too. Like it was always so bizarre, the types of personalities and how they
behind
would
that little curtain.
There's a whole thing. Yeah, behind the curtain.
I remember it being a huge deal because, and I mean, this is a really small Virginia town, but the porn DVDs that we first got in, I think they were Vivid, and it was, but I remember that you could switch angles mid scene. Yeah. And I remember so it would be like mid sex act and you would see these arrows come up and you could turn the camera and turn it again, and so it was just insane that you had this type of technology.
What button on the remote adjusted that camera angle,
and it took time because it would have to load, and then it would take you like 3 inches to the right, and it was a huge deal. But mostly, I mean, it was a lot of VHS tapes. But
I will just say this, by the way, about not to delve on porn for so long, but remember when Blu-ray first came out? It was Blu-ray versus HD DVD,
which was the red. It had a red clamshell, didn't it?
Porn first came out on Blu-ray, and that's why Blu-ray won the war.
So that is actually
available on Blu-ray first.
I have this theory that I need to sit down and write a book on that. All of our media choices, anytime that it has won the war, it has been dictated by Disney or porn. Mm. One of the two.
Both
Disney
accurate.
Goes VHS, porn goes VHS. We're all going VHS.
Disney porn?
And yeah, Disney
it's
porn.
It's going to crush the world.
It's been a thing. Google that shit, right? But
I have no longer any idea what the question was because now we've gone to porn. It's like a blank slate.
The porn section curated. Of Blockbuster.
Programming and curating. Okay, back to programming. Right. Well, so obviously, you were for many years, you were a very different job, obviously. You were working for Quentin after the video store. And I imagine that's a job where you did a million and one different things every day, I'm sure.
365, 24/7, right. A million different
which
things.
Which is wild. So you have to really like someone to be able to do that job with them, I'm sure.
I feel like he's my brother.
Yeah, because I mean the fact that you're still working together all these years tells you a lot. So, but let's talk about the transition from that to taking ownership of the New Beverly and taking the curating ownership, because that's a big shift. I mean, most people would like the bragging rights to be like, I own that theater, and then after a couple months of programming would give up on that. The fact is he's still completely involved. So just walk us through how it's done. I know it's, it's not necessarily hard, but I think a lot of people would be interested in how something like this comes across.
I'm very curious about day-to-day operations too.
Yeah.
Well, that's boring, but the program, for 3 years I was his assistant and ran the New Beverly, which was insane. But you always got a sense of what he was into because you'd see what was stacked up on the coffee table, or hey, can you run to Amoeba and get me this or that? And
I just remember the first time that you and I met.
Really?
Okay, so I remember this suddenly vividly. I was standing in Eddie Brandt's. And you were in there getting Emmanuel films for Quentin. And you asked him for a list. And I said, you need a Sister Emmanuel too. Sister Emmanuel too. And
yes.
I remember at that point you turned to the clerk and you said, do you guys have Sister Emmanuel? And he was like, oh yeah, we got that. And that was the very first time you and I met.
That's so funny because Quentin and I watched that particular one together.
So continue.
Oh wow. I love Eddie Brandt's too.
Yeah.
So even going back to when you guys first took it over to become the programmers, I'm curious how that all goes with programming at the first time. Was this always saying that he wanted to do with the theater?
I assume you frequently went there as a
frequently
fan.
Went there. I do not remember what year, but there was a time when the New Beverly wasn't doing so well. So we set up a meeting with Sherman Torgan, the founder of the New Beverly, and Quentin agreed to give them money every month. But he kind of wanted it kept quiet. And after a few years, it wasn't so quiet and kind of became known. And then, unfortunately, Sherman died suddenly.
Yeah.
So Quentin, I think he was in Manila at a film festival, and he hurt his back. At the same time, after Sherman died, the owner of the building sold the building. The building was sold.
Oh.
And I was talking to Michael Torgan, Sherman's son. And he said, I think we have right of first refusal. And I go, well, if you can prove that in your lease, let me know. And I'll ask Quentin if he wants to buy the building and help you guys out, whatever. So it was kind of crazy because Quentin really hurt his back. He was on the floor and could not get up. And I don't know, he wasn't hopped up on pain pillars or anything, but he was just in so much pain. And time was of the essence because the building was sold. So I had to ask him. He was kind of out of it and just, it was crazy. But I never ask him anything under that circumstance. I go, Quentin, I'm really sorry to bother you. I know you're in a lot of pain. You're out of it. But I got to know now, are you interested in buying the building for the New Beverly? And he just yes. So that happened. So he's a benefactor. He became the property owner. And at one time during the conversation with Sherman, Sherman gave him all the trailers in the New Beverly. He said, eventually, I know you want to run the theater. Because Quentin's always said he's always wanted to be a theater owner. Mm-hmm. That was one of his dreams. So, and then it just, just kind of happened. Michael ran the theater for 7 or 8 years, and then Quentin came in, just felt it was time. And
at what point was the programming all Quentin? Was there little hands of programming earlier?
He did a few things. He did a big Grindhouse Fest. He took it over for a month, which is very, very successful. Yeah. And that was a lot of fun and cool. But, you know, he pretty much stayed out of it and let Michael, you know, run everything and program everything until he officially took it over all the way and became not only the property owner, but the business owner.
And how does he have the time to schedule and program? Because obviously now I do a show where I have to we're interpreting all the choices and looking for weird puzzles amongst the picks.
This is a man of great capacity.
Okay, yeah.
But it's almost like the movies. You know, we go to the movies to escape. He programs to escape and he watches a lot of stuff and his mind works. He's a walking film encyclopedia. Yeah, totally, so he can this matches or, you know, this director goes here, the storyline, or this editor did this, and you know, so it's like a puzzle piece for him.
Does that ever cause problems though? Because I know obviously you've told me obviously you lose titles along the way because you suddenly want something but the rights aren't available. Does that undo the whole puzzle ever, or is that rare?
It makes it difficult, and oftentimes when you see the calendar come out on the last day of the month, that's because we're having problems.
Something falls through. Yeah.
Exactly. So yeah, it makes it difficult. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah.
Because some of the titles are so rare, are some of them really hard to hunt down, like who owns the screening rights for?
Rights are often hard to hunt down. Well, we've never had a problem with it yet. Prints are, I'd say, 10 times harder to find than the rights.
And harder now, right, than it would have been, 10 years ago. I assume studios absolutely are starting harder to lock things up.
And not only that, you've got prints that just deteriorate.
Yeah.
We wanted to play, say, The Goodbye Girl, and have a Neil Simon kind of tribute next month. We found one print in Australia. They pulled it, inspected it, and I just got an email last night, and they're like, it's faded red. I'm like, ugh.
Because then you'd have to pay to import it and all that shit.
Yeah, but we can't play a red print.
Yeah.
You know, Neil Simon, you know, Goodbye Girl is perfect for now. I can't believe we dropped The Goodbye Girl on your podcast. Hello.
I know.
Jesus, everything.
Don't worry. No one will be talking about it. Not a single horror fan.
They do not
register.
Care that we're not playing The Goodbye Girl.
But they will be talking about Amityville, so that's something.
Yeah, well, there we go.
Just for someone who, because I don't understand theatrical at all in this regard, but so for argument's sake, if I want to screen a double feature at the New Beverly on Monday night, whatever it is, what is the process for that? I have to find a print, and then I have to get permission from.
Well, I start with the rights. Mm-hmm. So I try to always find the rights. Usually, the rights holder has a print, but the over 50% of the movies we play, Quentin owns the print of them. So that's another thing why he got the theater. He really wants to, and I get this now. I always got it, but he wants to share his collection with people. And you guys were there last night. Mm-hmm. I mean, those prints weren't his. They were Phil's, but they got to be shared with a very appreciative audience.
Yeah, it's a pack. So, and I know
so
horror
nice.
Always gets a great audience for you guys.
Yeah.
Like, I doubt you have many seats left when you play horror films, I have to assume.
No,
last night we
turned probably 40 people away.
Oh, gosh, it was nuts last night. Like, wrapped around the block. It was wonderful.
Crazy good.
Yeah, it was really cool. But
did that answer your question?
Kind
completely?
Of. Well, I mean, again, it's like for anybody that I don't fully understand. So it's like,
okay, so
how do you get rights? So
a lot of studios, like the major studios, they have a specific repertory team that books the films, and you send them a booking request, and I say, well, I want to play such and such title. Like Slumber Party Massacre was part of Criterion owns the rights to that. So
really?
I email
Criterion.
Well, not Criterion, not Criterion,
not Criterion Collection.
Yeah, not the Criterion Collection. No, Criterion. It's a distribution label, and they own all the Corman stuff.
Oh, okay.
I feel that's going – the Corman stuff's going someplace else though. So you just – you send a booking request, and they'll send it back. Now, sometimes things will be out of release, or there'll be some event, and they'll be like, no, you can't play it, but you can play it next year.
Mm. Do the prices vary wildly between studios and rent the
stuff?
They're
all kind of in the same ballpark. It's when you get to like some of the foreign distributors, like in China and Italy, they just have a crazy sense of value and want to charge $1,000. And it's like, no, we can't pay $1,000 to run a one feature of a double feature, I mean, we're not making any money that
right.
way.
And it's also a theater where the ticket prices have not inflated like
we
a regular
$10 yeah. for a double feature.
Yeah. And the snacks are still cheap. So, I mean, it's if you're not inflating those prices, then yeah, you probably have to watch that. But I always do wonder, what are the margins? I mean, we don't have to – it's kind of probably a little too inside baseball.
No, but the New Beverly makes no money.
Right. So it's almost like a non-profit,
a labor of love.
Yeah.
Wow.
And you would probably guess, oh, it looks really nice right now. You guys have definitely done
beautiful.
That. So.
Thank you.
It is nicer than most, like, multiplexes.
Oh, my goodness. I hope Quentin listens to this.
Yeah. So do we. Please, encourage.
Except for the part where we're in his house. without him knowing. That's creepy. We don't want that out there.
No, he knew we were there.
I don't know. I don't think he ever knew us.
Elric just comes
I'm
in.
I'm still
wow.
there. Right
around.
Now, I'm there.
I actually thought you guys – I'm really surprised. I thought you had met.
I had come over.
Well, he must have heard my voice by now, so that's like.
I watched Hammer films there, a lot of them. It was
you're
fun.
Lucky.
Yeah.
Oh, man, I wish we'd do more Hammer stuff.
Yeah, oh, my gosh.
I actually agree with that because I think that's the way to see those movies. I think Hammer movies at home lose something mm-hmm. just watching on TV. But with a group of people on a screen, mm-hmm. I think you can really get into that world.
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. And they're so beautifully shot. And I think that's, yeah, the cinema. Yeah, let's put a poke in for more horror.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, he's a huge horror fan.
Yeah.
And, we've done all – October, a couple years in a row, I think, is all horror. I hope he does that again. I don't know, but we love it.
So now I also know you've written down some horror titles. I need to know what the context here is because you told us we're going to turn our podcast around here. So there must be something going on.
Is this our U-turn moment?
Because we didn't even have a question.
Moment?
Well, I'm
okay.
curious. So we can always dial back. So.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you because it came about because we were talking before Slumber Party Massacre and what horror movies are we going to talk about? And blah,
with
blah,
Bob Murawski, another
with
cool
Bob
guy.
Murawski.
He's been on our show years ago, one of our
yes.
all-time favorite guests. I got to say, Bob,
oh my goodness,
Bob, you can talk movies all day with that man. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. There's another guy that knows my film.
Yeah.
So then I'm like, oh man, am I the right guest or not? But so then I went home that night and I said, well, I'm going to look through my DVD collection. And of course, I wrote down a bunch of notes. And then I saw this piece of paper sitting next to my notepad, and I said, oh, that's why I didn't throw it away. I was cleaning out my house on Saturday, and I got a shredder. Well, work got a shredder, and I borrowed it. Let's just be honest. You can even see where the staple – I was so close to shredding this.
Yeah.
I was going to shred it. And then you had mentioned when we were at the New Beverly, that's okay because we're all into video, so we're going to talk about video stores. Yeah. I'm like, cool. I could go on there. But then this is a letter that I wrote. Me and my friend Laura wrote to Sam Raimi when we worked at a video store.
Oh, this is a Murawski connection right there.
yes. And I said, wow, I could read this and show everybody what an uber geek I am.
Love it.
And just embarrass myself. Yep. And I said, I have
this is the right show.
Zero problem doing that. Yeah. So can I read you the letter?
Oh my gosh, yes.
And we'll put some music under this.
Oh, this is lovely. So this is dated July 14th, 1994.
All right.
Now that's that's over 20 years ago.
That's crazy.
Dear Sam Raimi, my friend Laura and I attended a test screening of The Quick and the Dead. I wish it was a horror film, but it's not. Of The Quick and the Dead at Man's Del Amo in Torrance. We were awed by it. Not only did we have the privilege of watching your film, but we were in the focus group afterwards. We were the opinionated redheads in the front row. I use the fake name Cindy. I hate to assume a holier-than-thou attitude, but what a bunch of morons in that group, except us. Our major problem wasn't that they weren't enthusiastic about the film as we were, but they couldn't articulate why they didn't like it. I don't know seemed to be their stock answer. We can go on and on about your film and your other films also, but we're trying to keep this somewhat short. I will say one of the biggest compliments I can give you is praise for Sharon Stone's performance. For you to make me appreciate Sharon Stone is nothing short of a miracle.
Wow. You're a troll before the troll.
For Laura, her favorite Western director is Sergio Leone. She loves his style, and she felt she was given a gift with your film. It was a Western made just for her viewing pleasure. Laura was so impressed that she even went up afterwards, despite being terrorized, and shook your hand. Here's the video part. We are currently working at Video Archives. While Archives is a good training ground because of its exceptional selection, we feel we've served a fruitful tenure there. Graduation day has come, and it's time to go on to the next level. We want actual film experience. We feel it would be a tremendous learning experience working for you. We'd be great assistants. You wouldn't be disappointed in us. We're organized, punctual, and hardworking. Laura is a work animal, and I'm a fireball. I know this may seem odd, and we may indeed be odd, but we're not freaks. Left to center, yes. Freaks, no. So if you have any projects coming up and need some help, please contact us. Can you believe that, I wrote that and thought that would go
anywhere? But did you send
anywhere?
It? Did you send it?
I felt I gave it to Quentin. I said, you know, Sam, give it to him.
Oh, my God. Did he ever respond?
He never responded. And then I met somebody like a few years later that knew him. And I said, oh, my God, you can't even believe what I wrote in one day. She said, oh, it's fine. You know, it's like hilarious now. I can laugh at that and myself.
But also funny that you would go on to be Quentin's assistant. So it's like, it's not like you had a major difference.
That's the ironic thing. It's like, sorry, Sam, I'm Quentin's assistant.
Did you guys ever write letters? Because I did.
The only email to a professional was Bruce Campbell when I was 15. And I, when email, or 16, whenever email first started, like, I mean, first email, I wrote to a celebrity, I wrote to Bruce Campbell, and he wrote back. I said I had this idea. It was like a Monster Hunter movie that I wanted to do. And he wrote back to me straight away. And it said, Dear Elfrick. he goes, "If I swear to God, he just wrote, if you find the money, give me a call. Bruce. I mean, it was so cool that he, A, butchered my name, and B, wrote back straight away, just go, hey, if you have the money, I can do it. But otherwise, yeah. And I was like, that is the coolest thing ever.
Because I was just obsessed.
Yeah, so a Raimi connection.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
I wrote to Dark Horse Comics because there was a bunch of comic books that they did in the late 90s that were, I think they did something called Zombie World or something to that effect. And I was like, I have the best adaptation of this. If you give me the rights, I will find the film. I'll find the money and get it produced and make it for you. And I think Mike Richardson was the one. He was the top guy over at Dark Horse. He wrote me back very kindly. He was like, sorry, Ryan, the rights are tied up somewhere else. But if there are any other titles that you're
interested in. Who's laughing now? You can literally call them right now and make that movie if you want.
When I was in probably third grade, we had to do a letter writing project for school where you had to write a letter to a politician or a celebrity. And I wrote to Garbage Pail Kids.
Oh, wow.
Like all of them.
What did you say?
That's cool.
I just said how much I loved them and that I, and my mom saved a copy of it because she thought it was so cute. She has a mimeographed, because that was a thing at the time, a mimeographed copy of like my handwritten letter.
Oh, wow.
And I said that I really liked Messy Tessie and that I really loved the Garbage Pail Kids, and they sent me a mint uncut edition, like a sheet of the entire second series, which I still have.
Oh my God. Yes. You got that shit framed?
I did. It's in my parents' house still. But they also sent me, they did a printing of these giant ones that were like 4x6 cards. And they sent me the entire full set of those mint as well, which I have out here. Because when I did the Garbage Pail doc a couple of years ago, I showed those and was like, yeah, nobody else has these. I got
That's amazing.
But then when I first got email, this was in college in like 1997. Email was a new thing to me. And everybody, I remember being in the dorm room and people being like, you know, you can email celebrities. And it was suddenly like, holy shit, you can do that. And somebody found Tom Savini's email address. And I emailed him in like 1997, begging him to give me a job as an assistant. And he sent me by mail, he snail mailed me a whole bunch of information for the Tom Savini School, which had just opened at the time.
Opportunist move.
Oh, you know what? To tie it back around to the Relic, I tried to get a job on the Relic.
Oh.
Because they were looking for PAs. And then because I was living in New York at the time, and I wrote a letter to the production office and realized they were shooting in Chicago.
I was telling them we showed the Relic trailer, and it's a great trailer last night. That was actually made me want to watch it. So
it made me want to watch it.
Huh?
I don't know about the movie.
I always liked
the trailer. Great.
Cahoga for life. Did you write any letters?
I never wrote to any celebrities, but I did have a family friend growing up, my brother's friend Joe, who he he kind of informed us. He was big into getting celebrity autographs, whether they were sports stars or whatever. And he's like, it's really easy if you make it easy for them. If you send a self-addressed stamped envelope with your items and you're respectful, they normally will sign and send it back. And so I did it, and unfortunately I lost all this in a house fire back in 2000.
Oh, no.
But I was like, well, I would love if my Fangoria with Total Recall on the front cover signed by Arnold Schwarzenegger. And so we sent it to him, and he did send it back and autographed that.
Oh, my
gosh. So I at one point had that crazy cover of Fangoria with the eyes popping out, and Arnold signed across it.
That's amazing.
Wow.
And it burned up in a fire. But yeah, no, that was it. I didn't really write any, because you know what? We were – maybe I was 15 when we started going to the Fangoria Weekend at Heart.
Yeah.
So to me, it's like I didn't have to write it. At once a year in New York City, we could go and meet our horror heroes.
Yeah.
You know, and that included people like Sam and Bruce.
That's right.
Yeah.
Wow. It's really cool.
So now we've heard the letter. We've heard, so was Raimi an influence in general besides, you know, Cookie Man?
You're a big Evil Dead stuff. Fan. Evil Dead, yeah. Absolutely. Army of Darkness. I love Sam Raimi.
Yeah, he's going to be down in Texas. Or praying
we can deliver that letter for you.
Praying to the gods. Yes, if you want.
We can take him on to scan it, and you should give it to
you. You have a hell of a resume now.
Now, I think
you have our word. We will deliver that, whether he wants us to or not.
Quick aside, we should talk about Quick and the Dead, because that was such an oddball time for Sam. Because I remember, like, I was coming off of, you know, the high of Army of Darkness, and then there was, like, Bruce doing Briscoe County Jr., which was also Western, and then out of nowhere is Quick and the Dead. And I just remember tracking that and going, oh, really? Sharon Stone? Who else is that?
Leonardo DiCaprio.
I was going to say, Russell that's another Crow. Connection right now because
I didn't even think of that.
Quentin's new film with Leo. Yeah.
How did it? You saw a preview screen. I mean, how did it play? I mean, obviously there was a bunch of dumbasses in there. But
no, I thought it played great. And then we went and saw the theatrical release and
that's
the studio.
Right, they cut it up.
Yeah. I'm like, oh, this isn't the same movie we saw. And I felt really bad, actually, for Sam. I'm like, yeah, it's not. They don't know what
they're doing. What did it lose?
You know, it's so long ago, I can't remember.
But I mean, just in terms of like the feeling, was it just
You know what? Kind of lost that, you know, almost that David Mamet, like boom, 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 like feeling. Yeah. So I just, that's what I felt. I'm like, I thought it just kerplunked when we watched it again.
Why can't we get a director's cut of that now?
I know. Sam, what are you doing?
Sam.
We'll listener of our show.
In Texas. Yeah. Clearly, listener of our show.
But yeah,
we'll
so
you
have,
in Texas.
So we have the Leo, and the main reason you're here today is you're going to spoil for everyone the whole plot of Once Upon a Time.
Never.
No, I know.
I've kept my job for 20 some odd years, by keeping my mouth shut.
Do you get to see it early, though? You'll get to see a cut.
No,
of it.
I don't know. It's always, I don't know. I've seen every one early. What I actually hate is, I hope he doesn't listen to this. I love reading the script and then I kind of don't because it's spoiled for me. I did not read the script to Pulp Fiction and I went to the cast and crew screening and I was just floored.
Yeah.
And I've never had that experience with the Tarantino film since.
Mm-hmm.
I've even tried to sometimes avoid it and like, oh, he's asked me to read it. I'm not going to read it, but then I do it. And I just, but I'll never have that experience again. But I have that Pulp Fiction experience, so I should be happy for that.
Seeing it, like we've talked about it actually with Pulp Fiction well before we were involved in New Beverly, like there aren't many films in my lifetime that I've seen that when I was old enough to see it in the moment and go, that's going to be a classic. Like most of that happened before you're alive, the key tentpole movies, right? But that was one when I was 16, 17, whatever I was seeing it in the theater going, oh my God, that's going to change movies. And then you're right. Right? It's rare. You probably get a handful in your lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
But that was one that was, I mean, because even though Dogs makes this huge impression, it was Pulp Fiction that I was like, oh, this is a different kind of canvas
completely
or
different.
Something.
Yeah,
it's such a good movie. But I'm excited about the new one.
I was so, they shot the one that's coming up on my street in Burbank.
What?
I live right on Burbank Boulevard.
They just shot down the block, too.
Oh, my. From here?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. All I know is that they shot on Burbank Boulevard because they closed everything down. And it was so fascinating to walk down and see everything that they brought in for it, the cars and everything.
Yeah, they shot by Chili John's.
That's where I live.
Yeah. Oh, you do?
So, yeah, I live one block over.
I loved Chili John's.
So, yeah. So we got to see the whole thing coming in. And it was crazy because I was shooting a much smaller size movie at the time. And then I'd come home from like 12 hours and be like, he's got a fucking crane in front of my driveway.
Yeah. I was shooting Once Upon a Time in Burbank.
It's real tiny. But he has like a DJ in between takes. There was music like setting the scenes.
There was music that I was hearing. It was crazy.
But Leone and a lot of people would do things like Friedkin. A lot of people would play, or Coppola would play, you know, play music before a take and then try to orchestrate the action to that. So it's like, I don't know if that's why he's doing it, but I think big set pieces, that makes sense.
Knowing what this is going to be about, because the posters got released today, it was definitely tone setting. And it was really
right.
Cool.
You're trying to set the mood for 1969. And I think a lot of the crew dressed in that era too, not just the cast.
It was pretty really cool. It was a really cool set to be watching from my yard with a pair of binoculars. So, yeah.
Right on, Rebecca.
I had a long lens camera.
So the key question will be, what could we ever, do you think, and it's probably, the answer is probably no given, but could, do you think Quentin would ever make a horror film? Obviously, it'd be his kind of film, but do you think would ever?
Because he's only got one more that he's going to do, so.
What?
Is that
he's stopping at 10.
10. That's it.
He's 10.
But he never talked about like long TV series and miniseries.
Oh, yeah. He could do, maybe we see horror that way. I would love to see a Quentin
Tarantino
horror
film. Because I love hearing
him
talk about horror. Every time I've ever seen him, he's a part of the Eli Roth series. Every insight about horror, I'm always like, I'd love to. Him and Paul Thomas, funnily enough, because they're friends, Paul Thomas Anderson's another. I think both of them would be really interesting horror directors because of their interests. The first time I saw Paul Thomas Anderson, he was looking at a horror book, in a bookstore, and he was reading the history of horror, and I saw him, and I was like, oh, what? But then the start of There Will Be Blood is a horror film. But then after that, it's just, you know, crazy epic. But anyway, so you can neither confirm nor deny, or can we go on record and saying 100%? I'm not going to get you fired, don't worry. And then me fired, so I don't want to do that.
Yeah, it's kind of snowball effect. It wouldn't work.
But it would be cool. But he is a big horror fan. So one day we will hear him.
Huge horror
dance.
Fan.
All right.
Yeah.
I'll take that as a win.
So I'm going to circle back to my video store question because
I'm still
amused that all of us worked in video stores and that this is kind of what became of us. So I want to know, what was on everybody's employee selection shelf? Like, what were some of your titles?
I mean, I did different eras at a video store, but my last era at the Facets in Chicago, you guys will think it's a bad joke, but I actually had to donate. They didn't have possession, and I had a copy, so I donated my copy to the store and put it on my thing and left it there. I had The Burbs. So Possession and The Burbs were two that I remember always having to tell people about The Burbs, which shocked me to this day. Like, you move out here and everyone loves The Burbs. But there was a time where oh, really? You were never a Burbs fan?
No.
Oh,
am I wrong?
No, you're not wrong, but I love The Burbs. I'm trying to think what else, what other big, I think it would always fluctuate which kind of horror films I'd play or some weird art house thing. You know, I'd always try to keep it super eclectic. Whatever.
Wait, did you say The Burbs?
The Burbs. But Burbs. Joe Dante.
Okay. Yeah. No, sorry. No. And I'm like, oh, wait, did you say The Birds? Hitchcock? No, I'm like, I'm a fan. Okay. No. Okay. Yeah, carry on.
It's the Bruce Dern one. No.
Well, surprisingly, we're playing that next month.
Oh, is that a reveal that we're allowed to make here, or where we have to edit?
Is that a reveal?
No, it's not. It's actually on the website.
Calendar's
on the website. Well, I mean, just today.
Albert's fishing for exclusives here.
No, I'm not. I'm trying to not make you say anything we're not allowed to say.
There's a Bruce Dern film festival. Not a tribute, a film festival.
Oh, cool.
That's awesome.
All through the month. So The Burbs is playing.
I'm so surprised to hear this. I had no idea there was a Bruce Dern
festival. That's actually why I thought you
I'm trying to hide my knowledge.
A whole chunk of April's already up.
Oh, wow. So you guys are getting ahead of the game now. So that makes – that makes
I know. Shocking, huh?
That's good. Okay, so yeah, I can't remember many more.
I remember I put Cemetery Man.
Oh, yeah.
Nice. I try to really throw ringers at people and try to surprise them. I had Cemetery Man. I remember Burnt Offerings.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, because I think you try to be cool.
Try to be super cool. Yeah.
Like, look at I show that's like, I wish I still had a photo of it because I worked at the Tower Records in Massapequa and Carl Place back in Long Island, and I had a rack. This had to be about 2000, but I had a rack with all my picks on it. It was DVD at this point. And before I knew him, Mike C, who I ended up co-creating Icons of Fright with, remembered my rack because he's like Dario Argento's Opera and Chopper with Eric Bana, like his first movie.
Chopper,
I think I put like the Boondock Saints on there or something. Run Lola Run had just come out, you know.
Yeah.
So it was like all these, you know, my quirky, cool Romeo's Bleeding. But I just remember when we first met, he's like, I don't know anyone else in Long Island that loves Argento and would pick opera. So I remember that on the rack. But I wish I still had the photo so I could see what other picks were on there because those are the only ones I can remember based on the year.
I remember that at my video store. That was like a rite of initiation. I remember when I showed up on the very first day, I was the only female who worked there. And the guys were like,
we judge you by what you put on your employees' pick shelf, so go. And I remember the first day I picked on the very first round, I picked Time Bandits and Murder by Death.
Oh, yeah.
And that they were like, you have passed. But then I kept getting weirder and I kept trying to mix things together. Like, I remember at one point I had Cannibal Ferox and Easter Parade because I was like, how wonderful are those two things next to each other? This person is intriguing. And I remember I always tried to pick music movies as well. There was a Perry Farrell had made his own movie. Damn right.
Oh, that thing's
with
crazy.
Casey Nicolai.
Somebody showed me that once and I was blown away.
I still have my VHS copy of it. So where she dies of heroin overdose in like the first 5 minutes and then he creates this shrine to her body and then goes on to tell this really homespun story about his journey with heroin. But I remember putting that on my shelf the first week I was working there. Hmm.
So, Jules, do you remember anything from your pick?
I was always trying to put foreign stuff on there. Oh, cool. I was really into like Australia, so I was putting like Picnic at Hanging Rock and My Brilliant Career. And then I would go over to the French section and I put weird ones like Joy House with Jane Fonda because I always thought it was like, whoa, Jane Fonda in a French film. Like, you know what I mean? You're like, oh, ooh. So all weird stuff like that.
Nice.
I'm always, I mean, because are there core, and I mean, just as wrapping up, are there any core movies that you've always wanted to show or have shown at the NUPEV that you haven't had a chance to, or do you have anything like that, or?
Notebooks full.
Oh, yeah.
Notebooks full.
What's the dream movie?
You get one.
Or the dream double.
You know.
The dream double.
The Jules double. The Jules dream double.
I don't have a dream double, and I've been able certainly to do a couple. I mean, well, actually, I did. I was really happy that I got a Friday, Saturday night to do a Japanese horror.
Which one?
I did Onibaba and Koroneko. So I was really happy with that. And the projectionist played one of the reels out of order. Boy, he doesn't work for us anymore.
I've told the story on air well before we met, but when I saw Tarkovsky's The Mirror at the NUPEV when I was 21, and it was the only first time I ever went to the NUPEV. And I saw the movie, and afterwards, you know, it didn't make a lick of sense. So I thought it was pretty. I walked out. And then I heard people talking outside. Yeah, he played all the reels out of order. It's totally, and you would never have known. Like the movie, it made no difference to the narrative of how it was played. Which I love that. That was my first experience.
That's very
long ago.
Tarkovsky.
So. Yeah, it's pretty fun. But this isn't a Tarkovsky podcast. So
you definitely mentioned Stalker a lot.
You could a little bit, but I'm glad that you're pushing some foreign ones. That was good. That's good to hear.
Yeah. No. So what's the list? Are these some of your horror favorites?
Well, these are just things that I'll just throw them out there. Obviously. The Evil Dead.
Yes.
I love Invasion of the Body Snatchers. And in fact, we finally – that's a print that the Donald Sutherland version that all the prints are red.
Oh.
But a guy reached out to me in that's from England just last week and said, I have a really nice color print of it.
Ooh.
And it's X amount of pounds. And I said, ooh, that's a lot. But – God dang it, I bought it.
Yeah. So, wait, people will come approach you with prints that they have?
Now we've got a kind of a little reputation that since we're a film-only house that they'll come and say, hey, you know, so-and-so's got this print and that print, but very thankful for that.
Ooh,
let's see what else.
That's exciting,
I think we might be playing this in May. I hope, fingers crossed, Jennifer's Body.
Oh, wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
Lair of the White Worm.
I love that movie. So
right. Amanda Donahue, Hugh Ho, whatever her name
Grant is in it. I saw that movie way too young to understand all the weird sexual imagery that's going on and the nuns and the boobs and the snakes and the boobs.
The leather.
Yeah.
It explains a lot about
it, doesn't it? Yeah. And it's got a lot of nun imagery
that's
in
your
it,
nun
too.
Movie. That's
and they beat themselves with snakes. And it's just a trip.
I love
Ken
that movie.
Russell at his best.
There you go. What else is on here? So now we get a little bit more science fiction. Okay. I love the Planet of the Apes movies. Yeah. Did you,
love them.
I love them. And I've been bugging him for 2 years, and he loves the Apes movies. I want to have ape movie, and then it's morphed into I want to have ape month, because you can do like monkey movies for the kitties.
You can
do Night of the Bloody Apes, you know, for the mid.
Oh my God, that movie's intense.
Yeah. I'm getting a print of that.
That's the ape race movie, right?
Get some Clint Eastwood in there.
I can't remember who did that, but
okay. I remember Night of the Bloody Apes being like, it's like a video
it's
nasty.
Crazy. It's
yeah, yeah, it was one of the video nasties, I think. Yeah.
Shockma.
Shockma's, yeah.
Shockma.
We could literally do that right now. We could program the whole
We've got your I whole
totally,
monkey month.
We should do that as a podcast. Yeah. Remember
oh, wow.
that.
Have you ever seen this?
No, I haven't seen that. Tanya's Island.
Tanya's Island.
Wow, that's
Tanya's
crazy.
Island?
Yeah. If you loved Emmanuel, you'll go, oh, ape with Dee Dee Winters on Tanya's Island.
Nice. Yeah.
That, and I think Rick Baker made the monkey. I wow. think, or maybe I could be
He cornered wrong. The market on like monkey.
We
got to
have
so.
Another yep. podcast where oh, yeah. we do this. Just do program yeah, yeah.
Tonight,
and
Project
give it to
X.
Any which way but loose.
Project X would be a matinee.
See?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And the great ending. One of the greatest endings I've ever seen. Actually, one of my favorite moments at the NewBev was the Argento all-nighter. And when it got to Creepers, and everyone's like, it's like 5 a.m. and everyone's tired as hell. All these Argento movies. And it gets to this crazy monkey and a switchblade moment that I won't go into any more than that. I remember the whole crowd woke the fuck up. And we were all just like, oh, my God. Even those of us who had seen it before, it's an incredible moment. So, wow. Yeah, I think we got to program this.
Monkey business.
Yeah. Monkey business. That's all you need.
That's it. I love it.
Yeah, we're not going to be able to top that. Now,
Rick Baker and Rob Bottin. Right. I'm standing corrected. Rick Baker
any last titles that you need to get out there before this is your chance?
This okay. Yeah.
This is like the greatest sequel, like
Reanimator
ever.
And From Beyond.
Oh, like yeah. if you ever played those together, I would.
That was like high school when yeah. I lived in the South Bay and we'd drive up to Palos Verdes and we'd smoke dope and then we'd just go see movies and Reanimator was so great. Yes. Being high, I can't believe I said that on air. I also want to say
it's legal now. It's we're good
in some states. I had not seen Sleepaway Camp.
Ooh.
Until like maybe 4 years ago.
Ah.
Oh my goodness. And that's one I want to play. I feel our social media manager, Phil, might have a print. I could be wrong. But that's one I'm dying to play. And I just want to show it to people that have not seen that movie. Yeah, but and I want to watch it with an audience. And, oh,
that'll sell out.
Felissa Rose has been a guest on the show before.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
And if you listen to a show called The Pure Cinema Podcast, it was mentioned on the latest episode by our guest, Millie. That was one of her parents.
Oh, was one of her parents with the kitty
and
the midnight?
She was like you where she
that.
Hadn't really seen it. Yeah, what's with the kitty. And she hadn't seen it like you till late. And I think it's a movie that whenever you see it, the ending lands so well that people just – you can't not notice that
Nothing
movie.
Nothing can prepare you for
like,
it.
You just – it doesn't matter if people – you spoil it for you, you'll still watch it and go, what? How did they do that? It's an amazing movie. So, yeah. So, yeah, it's a kitty midnight. It's good fun. So, I love all the.
hold on. What's a kitty midnight?
Oh,
yeah,
good.
I want to know what she paired it with.
So, when we first started doing the calendar, what we noticed, they have a section where they're doing kids' films, kitty movies, and they're midnights, but they're kind of lumped together. So, we read it wrong once as kitty midnights.
Yeah.
And I thought it was the funniest thing ever. And so, I was like, oh, we gotta program a thing where we have to pick a kids' film from our past that we love and pair it with the perfect midnight movie to make the most fucked up double features imaginable. So we had the host of Turner Classics Underground, because she programs amazing stuff. I love what Millie programs, and she came out as our guest because me and Brian love doing this stuff. And so that was our last episode. When we didn't have an episode, I wanted to plug it through here because it's closest to a horror episode we've done in a while, because some of the pairings are just bonkers. But it was a lot of fun, so... Yeah.
Kitty Midnight.
I love that idea. I would love to like do one of those one day. Actually, like put the two together and watch them together and be like, oh yeah, that actually works. You know, because it makes the kids' film way more sinister. You know, knowing what's coming after it, I think it's that's yeah. Anyway, Kitty Midnight.
Well done.
It's wonderful.
Well done, Kitty.
I think I've stolen too much of the airtime towards our other show here. I feel like I've circumvented.
Today on Pure Cinema.
Presented by the New Beverly Center. Right.
Well, to wrap up, if you like Pure Cinema, go on iTunes and leave a great review for us.
For either is fine. But it's been really cool to have you in here some more.
Oh, yeah, it was so fun. I loved it. Thank you, guys.
Yeah. And if a big horror month comes one day, maybe come back on and we can talk about it.
Absolutely.
Get everyone on board
love
for
it.
A horror month.
That'd absolutely.
Excellent. Cool. Okay, guys. We'll talk to you next week.
Thanks.
Yeah.